hear it later.
I did see Cliff and apologize to him. I said I just Cliff Benz.
Brett?
I didn't.
I'll call the order of the Rural Communities Economic Development Committee. Today's May 2nd, 2013. We have a Senator Whitsitt joining us today and Representative Whitsitt joining us today. This is a informational hearing on the Berry Point fire, so I will open up a hearing on the Berry Point fire. So the Berry Point fire was a fire that started last year in Lake County. This hearing is for information to try to draw some conclusions of what happened with that fire. Starting off today, we'll kind of have an overview given by Ed Shepherd, president of Shepherd and Associates. So is Ed, come on up.
Mr. Chair.
Oh.
Mr. Chair, if it's all right with you, I'd just like to put on the record, since we have a number of people that have traveled a long distance, I do unfortunately have to leave the committee about 4 to meet with another member that's been preset. I hope to be back to hear as much of the testimony, but I want to not be disrespectful because I need to leave for about 15 minutes.
Thank you, Senator Przanski. I think we'll understand that. Okay. Ed, thanks for coming and making this presentation and doing this overview for us. I really appreciate your help with this.
Very happy to do it, Senator.
Okay.
As you said, my name is Ed Shepherd. I'm the principal member of Shepherd Associates. Up to about 11 months ago, I was the state director for Oregon and Washington BLM, retired in June after 38 years with the agency, most of them here in Oregon. For the record, Shepherd & Associates completed our report under contract to the Forest Service, but my presence here today is at the invitation of the committee, and I in no way represent Forest Service here, even though I was under contract. You asked me to set the stage for the Berry Point fire, so I'll go down through some of the key things from the report. And if I start dragging on, you got a lot of people here, so just give me the signal, I'll speed up. Last October, I was asked by Regional Forester Kent Connaughton to conduct a third-party fact-finding report of the events of the Berry Point fire from the perspective of the local community, the forest, the Oregon Department of Forestry, and firefighters. And this type of report isn't generally done. It's not a normal process of the fire review process, but because of the concerns expressed to the Regional Forester and the Congressional delegation, I was decided to go through this this review. This review was not a forensic review of the fire, just kind of a informational review. The original direction to me was to accomplish 3 objectives: to conduct interviews with fire personnel and community members, to develop a common understanding of what occurred on the fire, develop a report that captures the common community and landowner concerns or narratives of the fire, and include lessons learned that might apply to future fires. We were to coordinate our work with the Fremont Wainema National Forest and with the Oregon Department of Forestry. I was assisted by my associate, Roy Montgomery. Roy is a very experienced wildfire expert and a former Type 1 incident commander. We started our work by traveling to Lakeview the week of October 29th, and we interviewed over 25 people that week, including landowners, permittees, county officials, Forest Service employees, Oregon Department of Forestry employees, and fire personnel. Mostly we interviewed folks in person, but we got some on the phone. And then the last day of the a week we spent out of Lakeview, the Evans and Acefelder took us on a trip through and around the fire, which helped us picture a lot of the stories that we had heard throughout the week. Over the following few weeks, we interviewed a lot of the firefighters that were spread out all over the country and weren't available down in Lakeview. As we prepared our report, the regional office of the Forest Service asked us to add an objective to make recommendations. It was recognized that there would be a lot of further review of this fire. So they wanted recommendations on things that should have a closer look. And when doing that, they asked us to drop the lessons learned objective because that was going to be done through other processes. And we submitted that report on January 9th. The Berry Point fire was ignited during a lightning storm on the that hit Northern California and Southwest Oregon on August 5th, with lightning strikes occurring between 9 a.m. and 11 p.m. that day. Energy release component was above average, and fuels were very dry, and conditions were right for a large fire. And by 9 a.m. On August 6th, the date of Berry Point fire was detected and reported. There were already five active fires burning in the Lakeview Interagency Fire Center, and more fires on the rest of the forest and the ODF district. The Berry Point fire was detected at 4:26 p.m. on August 6th by the Dog Mountain Lookout, and at the same time by an ODF fire employee. He was the first to arrive on the scene and initially took control. It ignited red X is the point of origin there at Berry Point. From the 6th through the 9th, fire behavior was influenced by heavy fuel loadings, terrain, warm temperatures, low relative humidity, gusty winds from the west-southwest, and unstable atmospheric condition. And these conditions led to high-intensity fire with spotting up to a half mile. Initially, the fire spread to the northeast up towards Drew Reservoir, and this was typical of direction of spread, and it's what firefighters expected this fire to do. However, a wind shift on the 9th pushed the fire to the south, and it crossed the Dog Leg Road that night and continued to push south for the next several days, eventually crossing into California late on the 12th or early on the 13th. Burning conditions continued to provide for intense fire until the weather moderated on the 17th and some moisture hit the area on the 18th. The fire increased in size between 5,000 to 29,000 acres each day for a period of from August 10th through the 14th. So it's an indication of some of the conditions that were out there. After the fire conditions moderated, activities continued up to the 27th when Berry Point was declared contained, and after that, mop-up and patrol and the start of emergency fire rehabilitation occurred. The management of the Berry Point fire was under the jurisdiction of the Fremont-Wyneema National Forest and the ODF Klamath Lake District. The incident management transitioned several times during the fire. And from August 6th to the 7th, it was attacked by local forces during initial and extended attack. They were managed by the local Forest Service and ODF offices. But late in the day, on the 7th through the 8th, it was managed by the South Central Oregon Fire Partnership Team 3, which retained much of the existing local organization that was already on the fire. On the 9th, the Pacific Northwest Blue Mountain Incident Management Team, this is a Type 2 team, assumed command and continued in command through August 12th. Because of the growing complexity of the fire, it was decided to augment that team with the National Incident Management Team, a NEMO, that worked jointly with the Type 2 team through August 14th. Command was then transferred to a Type 1 team, the Pacific Northwest Team 2, on August 15th, and they commanded to the 24th, where it was turned back to the South Central Oregon Fire Partnership Team. But because there were still a lot of folks on the fire and it was pretty high complexity, they also augmented that with the NEMO team again till the 27th, and then on September 5th, they turned the fire back to the local units. So in a period of roughly 20 days, you had six transitions. The agency administrators, or their acting, were engaged with the IMTs throughout all phases of the fire. They issued joint delegations of authority to the teams that provided principal objectives for managing the fire. There were many objectives, and they grew as the fire grew, but there were three generally that related directly to private lands. I'm not sure how to... There we go. Three that related to private lands, and basically they were to minimize acreage burned and damage to private property and improvements, to protect private property and structures, and to maintain and enhance the relationship with local landowners and the public. This slide here shows just some of the ways that expressed in the fire documents. They all related basically back to that three. During the course of the review, there were several concerns and issues raised by the landowners, by Forest Service employees, ODF employees, county officials, and firefighters themselves. Throughout the review, we heard many similar stories, and there are many events that were reported both by the stakeholders and Forest Service and firefighting officials. Some of the reports were from similar perspectives, while others were reporting similar events, but from different perspectives, which would be expected. The issues in the report are just as they were reported to us, and we attempted not to interject our opinion or judgment into what we heard. In other words, we were trying not to be Monday morning quarterbacking since we weren't there on the fire. It was not our assignment to determine the accuracy of what we were told. However, where possible, we tried to corroborate what we heard with what we found in the records. One thing I think it's important to point out, that there was universal agreement with everybody that we interviewed, landowners, firefighters, forest officials, that safety was of utmost importance. There was disagreement on how risk was or should have been managed on this fire, but everyone agreed they didn't want to see anyone hurt fighting this fire. And there were no major injuries reported on the Berry Point fire, but there were events and there were areas where there was a potential for serious injury. The Forest Service, ODF, and some landowners interviewed agreed that the initial and extended attack was rapid, aggressive, and consistent with accepted firefighting tactics for the fuel type, weather, and terrain. And the initial and extended attack was, as I said, carried out by local firefighting resources from the agencies, you know, with assistance from Collins Pine folks. At least two landowners interviewed felt that the fire could have been controlled at initial attack had all resources been available. And this, I think, came about because there were some dozers that were not utilized, and I understand there were reasons for that, like hours maxed out with the operators coming from another fire. The Forest and ODF recognized this was going to be a difficult fire from the start in order to the Type 2 team, even before the Type 3 team arrived. Even with that, some of the fire managers that we interviewed commented that they underestimated this fire and that it behaved differently from other fires in the area with its spread to the south. Using 20/20 hindsight, some fire managers wished that they'd gone directly to a Type 1 on the Type 1 team on day 2 because of the fire's growth. The decision to go with a Type 2 was based on their experience and intuition at the time, and the analytical tools that they used backed up this decision to go to a Type 2 team. Many of the issues and concerns from the Berry Point fire occurred during the time that the Blue Mountain or a Type 2 team was in place. And of course, this is the time when the fire was making its most dramatic runs. By the time the Type 1 team was on the fire, it was well into California. And the experience of the Type 1 team members helped with some of the issues that had been raised, but there were still concerns expressed on how the Type 1 team members related with landowners and their performance late in the incidents, where the fire spread had been pretty much checked and they were trying to tie off parts of the line. For the sake of time, I'll summarize some of the major issues that we captured in the report. And it doesn't need to be said that communication is critical in any incident. At any time there's a serious situation that we investigate, and I've been on several investigations over the years, we find breakdowns in communications. And this was certainly the case in this fire. There are reports where communication went well in the Berry Point fire, such as between the structure protection group and the homeowners, and there are many reports where it didn't go well at all. There were communications issues between the forest and the IMTs, between the Forest Service and the Oregon Department of Forestry, and many reports of breakdown between the firefighting resources and landowners and permittees. Some of the other issues besides communication relating to communication, though, included the suppression strategy was not focused. There were attempts to use direct attack early in the fire, where many interviewed felt that indirect attack may have been more successful given the intensity and spread of the fire. The plans for indirect attack were not fully implemented because the forces were diverted to direct attack as the fire made runs. Many expressed concern over the use of the box, referring to points on the map for potential containment of the fire based on predicted fire growth related to fuels, terrain, weather, and available firefighting resources. Some felt the box was too small initially to allow for successful containment, while later it was drawn very large with the perception that of many that it was larger than it needed to be. Many felt that changing fire conditions could have allowed for the box to be shrunk down. Indirect attack applies to use of backfiring operations. There are many reports of a lack of communications on when and where this would occur or an explanation of the objectives. Some question the authority of the firefighters to burn in private ground without permission. The amount of acres burned from backfiring and burnout operations was very large on the fire, and this remains to be a big question with many of the landowners. There were many reports of planned actions not being accomplished because of a lack or misuse of resources. After the fire crossed the Dog Lake Road on the 9th, the IMT decided to use the Ruby Pipeline to stop the fire's movement south. This did not occur for many reasons, but one reason was adequate resources were not assigned to accomplish this task. Forest, ODF, and landowners reported crossing the fire area several times, moving cows or doing other work, without seeing firefighters in an area where they thought they should be, or reporting firefighters held up in staging areas waiting for assignments. There's often legitimate reasons to do this, such as safety. Part of the problems with this is that the rapid growth of the fire caused plan changes on the fly, and it was a long lag times of reassigning firefighters and getting the word out what the new plans were. Some firefighters, not knowing what the plans were, gave inaccurate information when they visited with landowners, and this only added to the confusion of what was going on. Many also reported long gaps between shifts. We consistently heard 2 to 4 hours when no one was on the line. Now, this problem was reported by both forests and by the landowners. Coordination between the Forest Service and ODF didn't always occur. The Forest Service had protection responsibility for the national forest and ODF for the private lands. ODF has a, as you know, specific charge to reduce damage to private land and resources. The agencies reported work very closely throughout the year and on many things, and there's a general agreement that day-to-day working relationships are good and effective, but in the heat of the battle, the relationship didn't work as well as they should. Several people reported that the IMTs could have relied more on the local knowledge of the terrain, road, and conditions. This is especially important when teams come in from outside the area. Examples given where locals suggested where control actions could or burning could occur, and some of these suggestions were successfully implemented, and some were ignored. There were also reports from landowners of arrogant attitudes and insensitivity by the firefighters and forest and ODF personnel directed towards the landowners, and likewise there were reports of lack of respect directed from towards the firefighters from some landowners. Well, there are a lot of other issues that we addressed in a report, and you all have copies of the report, but we were asked to come up with recommendations. We came up with 4, and I won't read those for the sake of time. But in closing, I'd like to point out that there were many things that occurred in Berry Point Fire that went well. And reviews such as this, we focus on the things that did not go so well so we could learn from them. One of our original charges was to capture lessons learned. The Forest Service, as I said, has other processes to do this and has or will be implementing those processes. I'm aware that there are other reviews that have occurred. One that in part looked at our findings and addressed our recommendations. I understand that's nearing completion and may be out very soon. When the focus of our review changed, some of the stories we heard from landowners were consolidated, and this led to the full stories not being heard. The regional forester asked that we supplement our report with the stories of the Oregon stakeholders that we interviewed. We have nearly all the stories in, and we'll be submitting that report to the regional forester, I hope, next week. Fortunately, there were no serious injuries or homes lost. However, many people were affected financially by the loss of timber forage cattle fences, and other infrastructure. And many were affected from the loss of family legacies and emotional ties to a piece of ground that's important to individuals. These non-economic losses can't be measured. The challenge for all the parties, state, federal, county, landowners, and permittees, would be to start to move past Prairie Point Fire and look to the future to build better ties between the agencies and the stakeholders. And for the sake of the community, I hope this can happen, and maybe this hearing will be a good start on that. Thank you, and I'm available for any questions.
One second, Doug. I want to back up to the progression map, just for the record, so people understand what a progression map is. Maybe you could describe it, and also describe, when you talk about the box, what that means,
sure.
And then we'll go to Senator Witz that has some questions.
Progression map is a daily map of how far the fire spread during that burn period, and the different colors indicate the different days. I'm not sure you can read the legend up there on the upper right-hand side, but those are the acres that the fire was on the different days and how many acres burned that day. The box is you pick control areas. It might be terrain, it may be roads, changes in fuel that you, and I fire such as this, where you're going indirect, you back off to control the fire from. When I was fighting fire, we call it the box. The first time I ever heard it called the box was down in Lakeview this year, so I guess that's a fairly new use of the term, but the basic idea is to fall back and pick control points. A lot of that is what you feel you can do based on the growth of the fire, the weather conditions, and the forces that you have on hand where you can safely control the fire. And it's a judgment thing and some analytical tools to help you decide that. So.
Senator Whitson?
Thank you, Chair Bertschinger. First, Mr. Shepard, thank you for being here today. Thank you for taking your time to do this. And I know the people of Lakeview very much appreciate it. The question, this fire burned 93,000 acres over a couple of weeks. 145 square miles, which is about the size of the city of Portland, to put it into perspective. And in our meeting with regional forester Ken Connaughton in Lakeview, one of his top forest people, fighters, said that at least 60% or more of the resources burned were burned as a result of being set on fire by firefighters. And the question is, isn't that a little bit excessive in a normal firefighting procedure?
It's a lot of acres, Senator, and I can't really answer if this was the right move down there or not, because I wasn't there, but in my experience, that's very large acreage.
Thank you.
Representative Whitson?
You mentioned that at some times, and I'd like to know how many times, there were 2 to 4 hours with no one on the fire lines. Could you tell me how many days that occurred or when that occurred?
I can't tell you that, but from my recollection, it was primarily when the Type 2 team there was there, so that would have been between, what, the 7th and roughly the 14th. It may have gone after that. I don't know, but it was something we heard pretty consistently. Even from some of the fire folks, that there were long gaps in that.
May I follow up?
Yes.
I just wondered, how often does that occur in major forest fires where there is no one on the fire lines from 2 to 4 hours at a time?
Well, in my opinion, it should not occur. I know that it does occur from time to time. It's generally when there's something is messed up, but something as regular as this should not occur.
Thank you.
Ed, when we look at your fire progression map, it looks like that the significant run was on day four or five? Is it the first real significant run? And then after that, you know, she really took off. But it looked like the first few days, you know. I wasn't on the fire, so I don't know what kind of fuel mods we went through or anything like that, but according to that progression map, it looks like the first 3 days, was pretty consistent fire behavior, just looking at the rate of spread. But then we got into some different fuels or something, and she took off. Am I reading that map correctly?
Yes, I think that's correct, Senator. And once, of course, once they get big, they make their own
right
fire, or their own weather, and take off.
Yeah, that's the first thing I've always said. It's a lot easier to put out a small fire than a big one.
Absolutely.
Just a quick question. Where on that map is the Ruby pipeline? Because you said they were going to try to stop it at the pipeline.
Some of the locals might be better, but basically it runs pretty close to the California border.
I'll get it to you.
Okay. So that was into a few days of the fire. And how wide is that buffer?
300 feet.
It is 300 feet, okay.
Yes.
Which would have made a pretty big break, you would think. So, okay.
Very much so. The other thing to point on this is fire progression. But when you say large areas, the days that it ran, it wasn't that it ran. You take this area in here, there were being backfires set into us from other areas.
Okay.
So, yes, you may have fire coming this way, but they sent fire into us from opposite way.
Gotcha. Thank you.
And that line that we see there is a California border.
That's the California border, right?
Thank you.
Could you state your name for the record, please?
James.
Yeah.
Yeah.
James Evans.
Thanks, James.
Thank you. Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. Just one other question. I know there's a lot of testimony to be given today. There was significant, I didn't hear you mention this early on, but early on in the fire, there was significant concern by a number of the local residents that there was a great deal of equipment that was available on the fire that was not being used on a fire. Cats that were parked, cats on a low boys that weren't even unloaded. In your investigation of this fire, did you make any attempt to determine why that happened?
The only one we attempted to find out why that happened, and that there were reports of that throughout the fire, right from the start, was we questioned why at initial attack weren't the dozers used that were there, and we heard a number of reasons for that from different folks. But what we got from the record is there was an operator that had come from another fire, and his hours had maxed out, and policy doesn't allow them to operate, which is as hard as it is, it's understandable, because if something had happened, we'd be here investigating for another reason.
And the follow-up is that there was just, in your investigation, there was only one incident of that, because I actually talked with the landowners.
There were several throughout the fire. That was the only one we
That's the only one you with. Confirmed. Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that.
On the kind of the follow up with Senator Whitsitt's question on timing out as far as hours, was that on initial attack or extended attack?
That was, as I understand, it was initial attack, I believe, the first day.
Because I think on initial attack, we can waive the work to restoration.
Well, you can always waive that, whether it's wise to or not. And this person had come from another fire, so that's fine. As
sure.
I understand,
judgment
was made not to. So.
Okay. Well, you know, we can't second guess that at this point. Any other questions? Ed, thank you very much for coming and doing that. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. See, I'm used to Senator Roblin doing this. So there's this lag.
You're
over
doing
here.
Well. You're doing well. You're doing really well.
Okay. So our next panel is Doug Decker, State Forester, Nancy Hirsch, Fire Protection Division Chief. Thank you for coming.
Okay. Will we start?
Yes.
Very good.
Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Bearsugar, Vice Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Doug Decker. I serve as Oregon State Forester. I'm the director of the State of Oregon's Department of Forestry. I'm joined here by Nancy Hirsch, the chief of our Fire Protection Division. Before we begin, I would like to recognize Senator Whitsitt and Representative Whitsitt, as well as the members of the Lakeview community who have joined us here this afternoon, have traveled to be here to join us. We appreciate the invitation to be here with you, and we have you've asked us to take about 20 minutes to provide an overview of getting ready for the for the 2012 fire season, to review our initial attack efforts on the Berry Point fire, to provide information on our role in the context of the incident management team that were in charge of the Berry Point fire, and I'd also like to reflect on lessons learned from the 2012 fire season and talk about how we're taking stock of those lessons today. I've asked Chief Hirsch to lead us through last year's fire season and to address the operations at Berry Point and to highlight some lessons learned. But before she did that, I wanted to add a little bit of background, a few thoughts about our priorities and our values and the role of our firefighting business. Just to start, we are Oregon's primary forest fire agency. We began in 1911. The statute that passed that created the Department of Forestry was very clear and setting forth our primary mission as protection from fire of values on private forest land. And it basically tells us to do that in very close cooperation with private landowners. It's a role and a partnership that is at the heart of who we are as an agency. It's very important to all of our employees. And it's when it comes to fire, we believe we have a very clear, straightforward mission, and it is to fight fire aggressively and safely and to be an advocate for the protection of private resources. When we're working with partner agencies. We take these roles very seriously, and throughout our organization, from me as state forester all the way through our to our seasonal firefighters, we place a value on earning and maintaining the trust and respect of our landowners and cooperators, and this is something that we know we have to do every day, and every fire presents an opportunity to learn and to improve, and we'll come back to that in our closing comments here in a few moments. So. We are, ODF is Oregon's largest fire department. We protect 16 million acres of forests owned by more than 165,000 individual families, individuals, companies, counties, the state and federal agencies. Our fire business is the largest single emphasis for our agency. It represents 37% of our budget. 45% of all of our employees are focused on fire. It's the reason we were organized more than 100 years ago, and that ethic of direct aggressive firefighting is an important part of our work. Every Department of Forestry employee has on their job description some sort of fire duty. It's an expectation that you are part of the fire organization when you work at the Department of Forestry. We have some key performance measures that are set out for us in terms of our performance. And we have a track record of controlling the vast majority of fires that we fight at less than 10 acres. This focus on controlling fires when they're small prevents costs and loss as much as possible and protects the natural assets for landowners and for communities. And here's a look at the track record, which varies every year depending on a number of factors, including the number and location of fire starts, the available resources, the topography, the fuel conditions, and weather. And for 2012, I would add 2012 onto that chart to say we were at the 95% level. 95% of all the fires we control were at 10 acres or less. 2012 was a challenging season, and I've asked Nancy if she would summarize the way we've prepared for that and then walk us through the events at Berry Point, starting with the lightning on August 5th, walk through the fire operations that followed, our role with the IMTs, and then we'll wrap up with a look at lessons learned and how we're preparing for 13.
Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Bertschiger, members of the committee, Senator and Representative Whitsitt. I'm Nancy Hirsch, Chief of Fire Protection for Oregon Department of Forestry. Appreciate having the opportunity to speak with you briefly on a number of different topics. So bear with me and slow me down if necessary. So the first topic here is really the 2012 fire season, and to basically briefly reflect on what was the outlook for 2012. The greatest potential for large fire growth was predicted in Oregon's southeast high desert region, where drought conditions were expected to continue into a sixth year. As a result of these drought conditions, dry fuels and multiple lightning events, specifically in southeast Oregon, early in and through July and into August, over 1.2 million acres were burned in southeast Oregon, with obviously significant loss to ranchers, landowners, and the public. As it speaks to here on the slide, record fire indices, drought-like conditions persisted across the state into the second week of October, extending fire season and pushing wildfire indices to historic levels. You often hear about the larger fires, but perhaps not so much about the small fires in small print. This is really where our major work is accomplished, and State Forester Deckard just mentioned that in 2012, 95% of our fires were kept at 10 acres or less. Last point, point in case here for much of the discussion today, large fires impact landowners and the public. Not all forest fires were caught during initial attack. Significant fires for us included the Pole Creek Fire, Berry Point, and Cache Creek, all originating on national forest lands, which collectively burned over 190,000 acres, including over 15,000 acres of department-protected lands, obviously close to 11,500 at Berry Point and close to 4,000 at Cache Creek. So just real quick, two quick slides. This is the early season outlook, the drought forecasted, as you can see there in southeast and south central Oregon. And then this slide really showing the results of droughts, lightning events, fuel conditions, those circles that you see, the blue one, kind of the area of the drought that was forecasted. The other polygons there, Long Draw, Water Tower, Miller Homestead, Berry Point, those are all those large fires that quantified, you know, up and over 1 million acres and causing significant damage. So let me move to the next piece that I was asked to cover, which was really about initial attack on the Berry Point fire. I just want to touch briefly on our department's preparedness and readiness. In early August, with lightning in the forecast across much of the state, along with extreme fire danger and potential for significant large fire growth, we took specific actions at the local Klamath Lake District, essentially Klamath Lake and Klamath County and Lake County. We added one statewide severity resource, a resource that's really funded through legislators like you through the special purpose appropriation. It was a Type 2 helicopter and located it centrally on the district in advance of the August 5th lightning. District also canceled days off to ensure full staffing. What this slide represents are obviously 5,000 lightning strikes statewide, which unfortunately resulted in multiple wildfires across the state. So getting right into the fire on August 6th, our local fire protection unit forester was actually feeling pretty good that day, given that there were a number of fires that Ed had mentioned earlier that were basically contained. That was until about 4:30 p.m. when the Berry Point fire was reported. This brought great concern. Initial reports indicated the fire was on the Wainema-Fremont National Forest, about a quarter acre in size, but within minutes, reports said the fire had doubled in size with torching and erratic northeast winds affecting the fire, including spotting. Some of the challenges at initial attack, it was a joint response to this fire, Forest Service, ODF, our folks, and I'll talk about that specifically along with BLM. Having said that, access was a challenge with Forest Service roads being not brushed, essentially brushed in, meant that everyone had to hike into the fire. Also, it was burning in heavy timber and fuels. Fire was at the top of Berry Point Peak, burning downhill to the northeast. As Ed also mentioned, the fire history there historically reflects most fires burn, particularly large fires, burning to the northeast. Oregon Department of Forestry protected lands at this point were in the direction that the fire was moving, approximately a mile and a half away, but expected to move there, and this became our top priority. Department of Forestry Forest Officer was actually first on scene to this Forest Service fire and became the initial attack incident commander. Our duty officer augmented the dispatch response with additional ODF engines, a dozer, and the Type 2 helicopter I mentioned earlier. The initial attack strategy focused on direct attack with dozers and hand crews. There were also two single-engine air tankers that were assigned to the fire. Just after sunset, fire activity picked up, so most of the crews worked through the night, as well as a Department of Forestry dozer. At the end of the night, the fire was approximately 250 acres in size, and that local incident management team had been ordered. So let's go to day two, August 7th. Extended attack continued on this fire with direct attack strategy. The fire threatens and actually moves onto ODF-protected lands on the north side, north and a little bit east side of this fire in the location of Dry Valley. ODF engines, one dozer, and the SPA helicopter continue to work the fire. We also engaged two department air tankers that began to basically anchor and flank the north side of that fire to minimize effects on private land. We also engaged three additional department engines and a Bureau of Land Management engine directly on the lands in Dry Valley, which minimized the acres there. Hay Creek Road, which is about a mile and a half east of the origin, that little X and the white spot on the map that Ed showed earlier, is about Hay Creek Road's about a mile and a half east of that. That was established as a trigger point for ordering the Type 2 incident management team, which happened on day two. Landowner contacts began on this day for us when it was obvious the fire was progressing beyond an extended attack. As the fire progressed, it burned just across some private landowners' acres. We were able to minimize about 150 acres there burned, but about another 2,000 that were protected. And then was back out on Forest Service lands with the next nearest private land ranging 3 to 6 miles to the east. Landowners to the east were contacted to coordinate and meet on the 8th to develop a plan. On the third day then, on August 8th, we continued with the Type 3 incident management team in command, as well as that's when the Type 2 team came in and started shadowing with that local incident management team. Our folks were directly engaged, the resources that I've described, as well as we had a department, the ODF division supervisor position on that Type 3 incident management team, and other local overhead were gauging potential impacts to private land, providing input to the incident management team and helping where possible to ensure objectives were met. Bottom line there is, for the district there locally in moving and augmenting resources, they were utilizing whatever they could and everything they had there, both with the IMT and or augmenting. So the next ask that I had was to talk, provide a little bit of overview on the Department of Forestry's role with the incident management teams. Specifically in this case, this is a joint jurisdictional fire. It was a joint decision to order the Type 2 federal incident management team. The fire had been primarily on federal land and expecting fire to be suppressed. The incident management team reports to the agency administrator. So for us, that's the local district forester. The IC is reporting to and accountable to our district forester as well as the forest supervisor, in this case, the Wyneema National Forest. Our agency administrator provides, as Ed described, and develops and provides specific objectives that are handed over to that incident management team. We very much, through our agency administrator, advocate and represent landowners, as well as reach out to them and engage them, and that was fairly effective early on in the early part of this fire. We also engage them in planning meetings and briefings, et cetera. As the Type 2 team came on board, Ed talked about some challenges there. Our agency administrator and others engaged on that fire recognized that, and that's in part why the NEMO National Incident Management Team was ordered. There was an attempt and an effort there to beef up the operational capacity. Another way that ODF engages with the incident management team is through an operations advisor. This person has significant operations experience in fire. They're grounded, they're out there on the ground making recommendations and suggestions to the incident management team members, and they're a direct feedback to our agency administrator. The other two areas that we provided resources were through the normal ordering channels for the team that was there. Obviously, we used our air tankers, but there were other resources along with additional agency representatives, ODF engines, operations branch director, division supervisors, task force unit leaders, dozer bosses, heavy equipment bosses, crew bosses, and a helibase manager. The local district continued to provide and utilize local resources basically on a short leash. They still had responsibilities on wildfire protection of about 1.5 million acres, but they would plug in on a day-to-day basis where they could. Landowner coordination communication expectations. The district initially contacted several threatened and or impacted landowners, providing updates and involving them in the planning efforts pertaining to their ownership. As the fire progressed, the size and number of impacted landowners grew beyond the district's capacity. The district recognized this and formed a landowner liaison group, in conjunction with the incident management team. This group, comprised of a Department of Forestry employee, a U.S. Forest Service team member, as well as a local landowner. Their success was mixed for a variety of reasons, as you can see from the fire growth, the pace and rate of spread. So that fairly summarizes our role with the incident management team and how we directly work to meet our objectives on the front line in terms of minimizing acres burned. Lessons learned, really my last piece here, but significant for myself as well as the entire department and the staff.
Nancy, we're kind of running in some time restraints, so, you know, if we could be as brief as possible.
Okay.
I'm sorry, it's just that's how it went. That's how it's going
I understand.
Today. It's one of those deals.
So these themes are really outlined here. These are areas of improvement and lessons learned, the things that we have been working on since last fall, all winter, and this spring specifically. Coordination with and information to landowners needs to be proactive, ongoing, accurate, and timely. There's been a high-level commitment through up and through the state forester and my frontline staff to reinforce this, not only with our landowner partners and how in developing processes to make that work, but I've been in many, many forums of which Doug, State Forester Decker will cover here shortly. We're also looking at institutionalizing a more deliberate process where key factors are transparent and considered in reaching that decision on what team to order in a joint jurisdictional fire and at what point do you trigger a different action relative to what team is in place. We're also working to develop, so agency administrators, district foresters, and our agency have a template of solid, very prescriptive objectives that we can build on as we face the 2013 fire season. Key also is how that incident management team is organized, and we're looking at different roles that ODF can plug in should we be in an event like this in a joint jurisdictional fire with an interagency federal team. Most importantly, our outreach and communication has been on increasing our cooperators' understanding of the values at risk and the values of private land. And Doug will, again, cover more on this. Federal forest management and fire policy is the last one, and I think we've touched on that in terms of some of the challenges we're faced with.
Doug. Chair Berchiger, in the interest of time, if we have an opportunity at the close, if there's time left, we'd like to come back and talk a little bit about how we're carrying these lessons forward into 2013.
Oh, that'd be great. Okay. And I appreciate that, Doug. We're just, as you can see, the clock's ticking, and I got a whole bunch of people coming. Yep. So I really appreciate that.
Very good.
We could circle back around.
Okay.
Thank you.
Do you want to ask questions?
I'm sorry. Any questions? I'm waiting for you to do that.
Why don't we hold the questions until later?
Okay.
That's fair.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, so we have Paul Harlan has been on the telephone. Paul is the vice president of Collins Pine. You still there, Paul? Did you fall asleep, or what's going on?
No, I'm here, sir. Thank you.
Okay. Paul, could you describe what the losses were of Collins Pine?
Well, the losses that the Collins Pine suffered totaled 24,300 acres of timberlands that had fire on it. 21,000 of those acres were in California, directly just below the border, and 3,100 acres were in Oregon. I'll run through some of those impacts that it pertains to. That acreage is 25% of the ownership that Collins has been able to put together the last 25 years in the Lakeview area, and it represents a large part, and obviously a big hit to the sustainability of our operation. We have a sawmill with 65 employees and a pretty large payroll in the last sawmill in Lake County. To deal with the damages that happened, we had to invest $850,000 in infrastructure to be able just to begin the harvest operations, the salvage, in roads so that we could operate after the fire this last winter as far as salvage. we managed between the end of the middle of September and the end of January to remove 8,000 truckloads of logs off of Collins' ownership, which represented 30 million plus 30 million board feet. We also managed to salvage 3 million feet of other private timber. Some of those owners, I believe, are with you today. That meant that we moved 148 up to 148 loads a day off of that in the winter, and we are about 65% complete as far as harvesting the damaged timber off our off the properties.
Paul, could you describe how, Paul, our committee administrator says that we need to ask you your name for the record.
My name is Paul Harlan. I am Vice President of Resources for Collins Pine Company. I live and have worked out of Lake for the last 27 years for Collins.
Where did he grow up? Oh, maybe Coos Bay.
Yeah, maybe he grew up in Coos Bay.
I was born and raised in Coos Bay.
Okay.
Got to get on the record there.
Paul, could you describe that how the salvage operation is going, and then also how the timber is, how it deteriorates over a period of time and what happens to it?
The salvage operations, as I said, we removed 8,000 truckloads. We basically, you actually cannot figure out how you're going to salvage something and tackle something like this with, I mean, it's an absolute daunting task, but our group basically put it together in 1,000-acre blocks, figured out we needed to go far first and move in towards the middle, and we began to lay out harvest blocks and replicate that. And we got going with regulations in California and in Oregon and agreements all the way from water to maintain the roads to rock, and that got it up and going at its highlight. This winter, we had 14 logging contractors on the project, so it was a very massive project that was done with three foresters that we have. So they were, and that went well. The damage from the fire, the physical damage to the trees up to this point and up through the end of January is minimal, other than they are dead. From here on out, there will actually be considerable deterioration in that material as it dries, as it cracks, as it turns blue, and it gets bugs in it. We, up to this point, the ponderosa pine only saw a 6% degradation due to blue stain, which is a value degraded. We will see that increase to probably 50% this coming summer as we start back up.
And Paul, at what point do you think the salvage, you just can't, it won't pencil because the timber, you just lost so much between the bugs and the stain and sap rot and stuff like that?
Off our own ground and the other privates, I would have to say, Senator, that is going to be 12 to 15 months, and it's a marginal returns and decreasing returns as the time goes. It goes on the time frame. If the timber was bigger, it still degrades, but there's still economic value to be had by it. But about 15 months out, it's going to be looking very skinny.
Do you have any idea of how many thousand board feet you're going to leave on the table because of that?
That's an absolute guess. I would say that it is not possible to recover. Even if we were 100% successful, we will not recover 15% of what we lost, number one. Number two, the loss includes not only that is recoverable, because mature timber, you can at least recover it. Immature and intermediate age timber is not necessarily recoverable, so you've lost all of that investment and all of that time investment in those materials, and they're not physically recoverable. That is probably the largest short-term loss. The long-term loss is obviously the long-term sustainability and investment to put it back and to wait 60, 70, 80 years.
So that 25,000 acres, when you get it logged off and you go back and you do your replanting and everything, the next time you reap anything off those acres is going to be 50 years?
Yes, at a minimum 50. With a very large, you know, probably a minimum of, my estimate is we're not going to log, and there's not timber on all 24,000 acres. There's not complete damage on 24,000 acres. My original estimations are 17,000 acres, and it will cost $6.5 million to rehabilitate and reforest plant those 17,000 acres.
Yeah, with a return in 50 years.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Any questions?
Yeah. Did you? What I'm trying to get to is 50 years, and no intermediate stuff. So that's your sustainability issue. And did you lose a lot of the soil too, and nutrient stuff? So I mean, is this forest going to grow back like it would have grown back?
Senator, I think I'll answer your second question first. The soils down there, we were just down there on a tour with the owners and some of the board members yesterday. The soils for the most part are okay because the heat tends to go level and up, and actually some of that soil down there is very good tree growing soil. So we'll do pretty well if we get the trees in the ground, but we have to beat the brush component that grows on most sites like that. Yep. The brush absolutely will choke that stuff out if we don't control that. So we think those soils on our grounds are okay. Now, we may find some places that's not the case, but we think overall that that's okay. The first part about the sustainability, it will impact more than just the fact that we've lost these acres and not been able to get a ongoing volume off of those. It actually will back up and impact the whole sustainable model of where you go. It actually means that the impact is more than the 25% of the acreage that you lost. It will impact our timber flow more than 25%.
That's, yeah. Thank you.
Senator Whitsitt has a question for you.
Thank you. Paul, it appears that it's your testimony that almost 90% of your losses occurred after the fire across the Ruby Pipeline?
Yes. Okay. Probably 98% of it after across the pipeline.
And the other question, the Forest Service was unable to be represented here today, to my knowledge. Given the Forest Service lands were approximately 65% of the loss, to your knowledge, is there any salvage plan being nearing completion where any of the losses on this federal land could be salvaged or will be salvaged? And then could you also comment on whether the Forest Service is going to, would allow you to use their roads without fees, or did that also add to your cost of harvest on federal land?
Okay, let me keep track. I'll do your third question first as far as roads. In our case, our lands were tributary out on basically our own roads, and we will have pretty close to nil as far as outside payments to the Forest Service to harvest our timber because of the tributary roads. We did have to invest a bunch into that. As far as the Forest Service plan for salvage, they have a environmental assessment that I believe is to come out next week, laying out their plans, proposals for the salvage, and I feel their thunder, but it is a plan to harvest within about 100 and something feet of all of the road systems so that they take down what is in hazard of public safety on those road systems. And then the other part of that is to look at areas that were less than 35% slope that are within, I believe, 1,200 feet of an open road, and that's also in the proposal for the salvaging. So they're looking at salvaging a portion of what they lost in the in it. They expect to try to work through that this summer and hopefully have a decision that they can implement this fall on that. You had a third question.
Just one follow-up on that. How much, in your opinion, how much of the value of the timber will be lost even if you are able to start harvesting off forest land, say, in September or October of this year?
Senator, I'd say it's north of 50%.
Thank you.
Representative Whitson?
Yes, Mr. Harlan, could you describe for the committee the economic impact of the Collins Mill in the town of Lakeview and Lake County? Are you one of the larger employers there for the committee?
Representative, we are, I don't know if we are the largest, but we are one of the largest in the community as far as private. The largest employers in town are the school district, the hospital, federal government, and that. And I would say that we probably are tops in private employer payroll and benefits. The causes have operated a sawmill there since 1945, and I think the others there with you today could probably speak to that as well. The next sawmill manufacturing facility is the closest one, would either be in your hometown of Klamath Falls or in Gilcrest.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Harlan? Well, thank you very much, Paul. You feel free to remain on the line. We have a bunch of testimony coming from folks from the Lakeview area, including the sheriff and county commissioners. So feel free to stay on the line.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul.
Let's see. I think we're going to have, Sheriff Phil McDonald first. But, yeah. No, the commissioner is not the sheriff. The sheriff first. And if you could state your name for the record so I don't get in trouble.
My name's Phil McDonald. I'm the sheriff of Lake County, and I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity, and senators and representatives for the opportunity to be here today. I didn't really want to go first from this perspective, but directly affected by this fire, I'm not a landowner. I'm not a permittee. I was there for a lot of the incidents that happened on this fire, made a number of observations. There were some good things that happened on this fire. There were some not so good things that happened on this fire. The structure protection group worked very well. Myself and my deputies worked hand in hand with them. I was there. You'll hear testimony from some of the landowners of basically untruths or things that they were told were happen that would happen that didn't happen. I was there for some of those. I was there when, the number one safety, or the number one point on this on one of their fire screens was, life, safety, and property. I was there when the Albertsons property was burnt. No one came down and notified them. They had been out working, building fire lines on their property. No one from the fire came down and notified them that, hey, we're getting ready to light your property on fire. That didn't happen until well after the fact. Not all the Albertsons were together when that occurred. I've been to a number of the public meetings, and part of it in support of, and well, all of it, in support of the landowners and the people in Lake County. Just because I was there and could back up some of the stories, because you hear, people get emotional and they get in, and some of the accusations that come across, well, that didn't really happen. Your place was burnt and, you're upset about that. We understand. But I was there for a lot of it, for a lot of the things that they were told, or for some of it. But going to these different meetings hosted by, whether it was at the courthouse or at the interagency office, wherever it was, there's been a number of different things, and usually I try and hold my peace and be quiet. But a lot of statements were made, and there was a lot of disorganization at times throughout this fire. I mean, one of the statements that made, and I think this is why Senator Whitsitt kind of asked me to be here just as an example, was that, you know, we give all of our firefighters maps so that they can know where they're going and they know where they're at. Even though they're not familiar with this location, they all know how to read a map, and we give them all really good maps. Well, I gave away every map that I personally had. I had my emergency services coordinator go to my search and rescue building and get all of our maps, and we gave those to firefighters also. I found ambulances wandering around in the forest that were from California that had no idea where they were supposed to stage and where they were supposed to be. And I'm like, didn't they give you a map? And they said, yes, they gave me a map. I said, let me see your map. It's a photocopied grayscale, something that you can't, there's no way, if you didn't know the forest, you would not be able to find yourself anywhere in it. And so, like I said, there were a lot of things that did not go well. And I think I was asked to present written testimony. I don't have a lot of that, but I came so that, one, I could make these statements, and two, just be available to answer any questions that you may have.
Okay, questions?
No, I think you, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you covered it pretty well. It's the sort of random disorder and people being sent out into the forest with no hope of finding where they were going because they didn't have a map that was readable. Apparently not much directions on how to stop and ask a local person where they might be.
No.
I know that I share your concern that there were landowners and residents of Lake County were pretty well disrespected by their effort, but I'll leave it at that.
And there was, you know, I saw a lot of that. I mean, total disregard. And a lot of confusion, so.
Sheriff McDonald, at what time was this map issue ongoing the whole duration of fire? Was it early on, mid, or?
It was throughout. The California ambulance, they were, I don't think they brought the Cal ambulances in until, well, one, it had already crossed into California. So it went on throughout the whole thing. And, you know, they had resources there. They had a huge, big GIS system, I mean, or section. They had a big motorhome from Keno that they were, you know, paying however many thousands of dollars a day those things cost when they're through a contract for fire. I know working with the structure group, I had sent my deputies out. They GPSed every structure that was potentially affected by the fire on the Oregon side of the fire. It took at least 6 days to get that map back from the GIS so that it could be given to the, you know, the different crews that were working in these areas to show these are where your structures are. I mean, it just, there were, like I said, there were just a lot of inconsistencies.
Did you happen to have a liaison attached to the team or the information officer of the team?
I had a liaison. But the liaison's in the camp, and that was not my place. I was actively out in the forest with landowners, with, you know, peoples in the Drew's Reservoir area, where the main little subdivision was threatened was where the main subdivision that was actually threatened. I spent a lot of time in there, and then on the flanks of the fire along the Goose Lake Valley on the Lakeview side, you know, as the fire moved south and homes were threatened, you know, I moved, you know, into those areas. I didn't spend a lot of time at the incident command post. Mm-hmm. I went to a couple of their morning meetings. That's, you know, so yes, I did have a liaison, but
it wasn't you.
I gave him my cell phone number and said, if you want to talk to me, I'll be out there. So,
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Sheriff McDonald.
Thank you very much.
Okay, Ace Felder and Rosa Felder. Felder? Is it Felder? Felder? Felder. Okay.
You're right.
That's right. If you could state your name for the record, please.
Ace Felder.
Rosa Felder.
Okay.
thank you for having us, taking your time. We appreciate that. I'm not sure where to start, so if you have any questions, please ask them. I hope that you received the email that I sent up of our experience in the fire and then our letter to Ed Shepherd to put into the supplemental. I'm going to try and focus. First off, we own Felder and Navarro's ranches. I represent Tom Griffith, Griffith Livestock. I'm going to focus mostly on ODF because I feel that's why we're here. We own a 40-acre parcel that was structured right in the middle of the Dry Creek, McCoy Creek Basin. There was no saving that. The fire went through there. Nobody could get in there. I don't blame them. I wouldn't try and save it either. But when it came to other private land, we were denied service. We were ignored information we were trying to put forth in far as cat lines so that they weren't so destructive that they didn't burn up our private land. Oregon Department of Forestry is our paid fire protection. We pay them. And as far as I'm concerned, when we border U.S. Forest Service, when that fire is getting close or suppression efforts are going to be made on private land, Oregon Department of Forestry should be standing on that fence saying, whoa, we're taking control here. These people are under our fire protection. When I call ODF and I ask them to come put out spot fires behind these suppression fires, and they tell me that's not our jurisdiction and that we can't come do that, that's very frustrating. After the fact, post-fire, cat lines were constructed on the Griffith property, one of them in a very sensitive area, and in a very ineffective area. The fire blew past, the suppression fire blew past it, not let alone the wildfire. I asked to be present when those cat lines were going to be rehabbed. I told I was. They rehabbed the interior line. I was not notified. So I asked them again when Greg Pittman, Senator Whitsitt, Dustin Gustafson, we all had our feet in the black. There were Forest Service personnel there. I said it is of the utmost importance to me as a manager of this private land that I'm informed when you're going to rehab this cat line so that the erosion that's going to come behind this fire can be taken care of. They went in, rehabbed it, never called. I know that these problems have been addressed, but this is just part of the frustration that we've dealt with through this whole fire and the 9 months, and we're still fighting with it continually.
Mr. Chair, Ace, would you point out, please, that was on private land and actually they were trespassing on private land in order to rehab that that fire line?
That's what I'm saying, is I'm concentrating on ODF. Because they're just concerned, as far as I'm concerned, they're the private land fire protection. So I'm not even going to go into the Forest Service. I'm not even going to try and open that. I can answer any questions about the fire, myself, my wife, my family, 7 days. 7 days in the black. Oregon Department of Forestry needs to realign their criteria in fighting fire. And they need to step up and protect our private lands. And I don't think that that has been done. And I'm not sure that even through this winter, with the reports that were given, that this is going to happen. So I ask you to make sure that it does happen so it doesn't happen to someone else. Because I don't know if you can even imagine what this fire was like. And we're going to pay for this for I don't know how many years. I have no idea. I've never experienced one, so I don't know. But we will pay for it for a good many years to come. And the federal lands that are within Oregon are still in Oregon. So ODF and the state of Oregon needs to step up to the feds and say, hey, this is still our state. You need better forest management, and you need to listen to us when you're here fighting fire on our lands, and that's in the entire state, not just the Forest Service land. I'm a permittee out there. I deal with the Forest Service on a daily basis, and those are the hurdles that, like I said, I don't even want to go there with that. But change comes from the top, and you guys are the top. You really need to make ODF come to the table and fix these big issues. That's all I have to say.
You're a rancher more than a forest. So did you lose most of your cattle?
No, we didn't lose very much livestock, thank goodness. But we were in there for 7 days getting them out.
Okay.
The fire burned up our entire Forest Service permit. Okay. We'll be out of there for at least 1 year, maybe more, I don't know. Fences is a huge issue to get past, and we haven't even started on that project yet.
Are they replanting grasses and that kind of stuff?
They're not doing anything.
Okay.
As far as the planned salvage, my understanding it's about 15,000 acres total. But no, there will be no seedings done, no grass seedings done, no nothing.
Mr. Felder, how many acres is your ranch?
We have about 850 acres in the valley. We have a couple small private pieces in the forest, and our forest permit is about 18,000 acres.
And how many acres do you think was lost? So the ranch with your permit land, add them together, how many acres?
Our ranch is out in the valley away from the fire, so we didn't lose anything there. We lost two 40-acre parcels and the entire Forest Service permit.
So you lost 18,000 acres of permit land. Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Woods?
I was wondering if you could quantify the amount of money that translates to your operation, what you lost in the permit there.
A speculated loss in the permit this year would be directly about $30,000. The loss suffered to the Griffith property through the fire itself was in the neighborhood of $25,000. Because there was 3/4 of a mile of fence burned up due to suppression fire and then the loss of the grazing. So they had about $25,000. The $30,000 that we could potentially lose this year's income is really an easy pill to swallow. The hard pill to swallow is going back out there and rebuilding all those fences because we're the ones that are responsible for rebuilding those fences. Forest Service says they will provide us the material and we provide the labor. I ask them, can I provide the material and you guys provide the labor?
Yeah.
Understand this, cost share programs have been offered to us and they are going to be a great help to us. However, the FSA fence cost share program, 75% cost share, and they just found out that is going to be fully funded. However, we get to pay income tax on that money that comes in. We also upfront all of the costs to put those fences in, and then we wait for the payment. So, and my understanding is ODF has also got a reforestation program coming. I'm not sure what the percentage of the cost share there is. But the same thing, it's just a cost share. The people that lost a significant amount of timber, they've already paid 3 separate taxes on that salvage, that forced salvage logging. They had no choice. They had to get the trees off. And now they're going to get a cost share from the FSA. They're going to get a cost share from ODF. They're going to pay taxes on those as well. Also, as I learned the other day, possibly the ODF program, cost share program, is going to deduct all or a certain amount of the salvage dollars that they've received from their contribution to the cost share program. So some of these people that have gained money by salvage logging, whether they wanted to or not, that's going to be taken away from their amount of their cost share in reforestation. ODF demands if you salvage log, you reforest. I would like to see ODF go to the feds and say, this is still Oregon. you need to reforest as well. But I don't think that U.S. Forest Service has any plans to reforest very many acres at all. The last number I heard in a notice was 121 acres.
They didn't get a hold of you when they came back and took the the fire line dozer out. Did they do a reasonable job? Are you going to lose?
They did do a reasonable job. I would have liked to seen a few more water bars put in because, as I say,
when you start raining,
the erosion.
Yep.
Right. They have no reseeding program. We've went in and reseeded those cat lines ourselves.
Okay.
For the record, what's the estimate per mile for a four-strand range fence? What would be your cost estimate? 8 to 10?
Parts and labor, including tear out and roll up of old fence, you're looking a little over $15,000 a mile.
Okay. Any other questions?
Just one very briefly. Mr. Felder, has anyone gone in and cut down the dead trees or the dead that have been burned so that when you rebuild your fence, they won't fall across and destroy your fence?
The Forest Service has gone in and cut what they deemed as hazard trees that are close to the fence and really in immediate path of the fence. I've been in discussion with them over this. There's trees that are within a tree length and a half of the fence, or a tree length, that are extremely hazard to us, an extreme hazard to us, excuse me. We've been up there working on some of these fences, and we've had to cut some of these trees down. I'm not a timber faller by any means. My proposal will be to the Forest Service that within their salvage logging operation, that when they have the equipment in there, they go in on our fence lines and they clear that a tree length and a half, any tree that doesn't have 30% or more live needles on it. I don't know where that's going to go, but safety was always the big word during the fire. And now, post-fire and even during the fire, when we're in there trying to get our cattle out, it seems like our safety's kind of getting put on the back burner. And as time goes on, this is going to be a more serious issue as these trees die and they do start falling, and we're out there on an annual basis repairing our fences. So that is going to be a big concern of ours.
Any other questions?
Only if, Rose, do you have anything to say?
Yeah, I was going to bring her next.
Yeah. I guess the only
thing... You can pull that microphone over.
Great. Thank you. The only thing, you know, he speaks about the 7 days, and... The 7 days, unless you were out there to understand what we faced, when we went out day one, at that time I was just over a year of having heart surgery. But I also knew that I was not going to sit through another fire because we were involved a little with the Fletcher fire. That was going to be a little bit difficult. I was not going to send my family in and me sit at home. So when we did go into that fire for those 7 days, I will say we would get up so early. You know, we'd go at 4 o'clock in the morning to see where the fire was because nobody could tell us. So we needed to see for ourselves what we were going to be facing, where we could go, what we thought our risk was going to be. And then we would go in. The first day when they told us that we had probably 2 days, 3 days before the fire would reach us, we went in with some neighbors and small children, well, young, all experienced riders that have been up into the permit. And after that day and seeing how fast or where the fire was, we chose not to go in with any more young children that weren't as experienced as we were. We didn't do that. One girl we thought might have been lost, she wasn't. She knew where she was going, but it was too risky. So we were taking a big risk. We knew we were. So we chose to do it ourselves and only with people that knew the permit as well as we did. But again, you know, it was up to us to go and evaluate the fire and see where it was and then do what we needed to do to get our cattle out. and we did that for 7 days. The last day, one of the fire crews sent a truck in with us because they had seen a calf, and we needed to go get it. So we took horses in and went again. They took a truck with, or sent a truck with us. When we came back out to try and get back out, the fire had crossed the line. We could not get back out that way. They said, you'll have to go back the way you came, which the fire was active in that direction too. At that point, they did not send a crew with us. We were on our own. So we went back through. We could see the road that we would normally take is burning. So we went off-road to where a two-track road, which would be like for a four-wheeler, and we took our horse trailer and went through that and went through the burning fire. But it was our only chance. That was our last trip in. You know, we thought whatever is lost now, we can't do anything about it. When we got back home, at that point, our neighbors were in trouble, and cattle that we had up to the mountains, we still had to move those down the road. And then we went to our neighbors, and we weren't done till 12:30 at night trying to save their property. But that was our decision, that we just could not go back in anymore. But for those 7 days, we were up there. And for so many of those days, there wasn't anybody else around. So,
thank you.
Again, thank you all for allowing us to be here.
Thank you. Questions? We're also been joined by Representative Benz. If you have any.
Well, thank you for inviting me up to join you here. I'm sorry I'm late. We had another committee. I'm just curious, did you already ask how it looks for the coming year? Is it all indications in my part of the world, which is Burns, John Day, Baker City, is this really, really dry? So I'm just curious, are we going to see more of the same this year?
Absolutely, or maybe worse. I believe it could be worse. You know, they're already having trouble with these control burns getting away from on the forest. One other thing. I appreciate the presentations that we get, whether it be from Forest Service, ODF. But the people that are giving these presentations, you need to keep in mind, weren't there. They're giving their presentations based on information given to them. So keep that in mind. The other people that are going to talk behind us, they were all in there too. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's see, our Sharon Harvey and James Evans and Dally Evans.
I'm Sharon Harvey, landowner, and it's going to be hard.
It's okay. Take your time.
Anyway, thank you for letting us speak. My husband and I own 325 acres on the Dry Creek, and my husband and I were in there for the full 4 days that the fire was going through trying to save our property. The whole 4 days, there was really nobody there until the fireballs started coming over us. And he went up the 4020 to ask for some help. There was 20 to 30 guys sitting up there joking and playing cards. We told him that the fire had come across the 4020 and was starting into our property, that they had backfired into us. They called us a liar and said, no, the fire hadn't crossed the 4020. So my husband took them up there and showed them that the fire was coming in on us. So they went ahead and called in two or three trucks and tried to bring them down in. My husband got on his cat, went up and showed them where there was another old logging road where they could have come down. And it was all rock scab. They could have had the fire out, but they didn't. They said, no, the fire's too bad. By the time Virgil turned around to come back, they left. They bailed on us and left us there and said, well, we can't do this. It's too much of a fire. You shouldn't be in here. We didn't leave. We had sprinklers on our cabin and around our yard, and we did save our cabin ourselves. ODF never showed up down there. Not once did ODF show up. And at the same time, you know, we're trying to help our neighbors to the north of us, because the fire had, they had prepped the road up to the Morrises and then just kind of forgot us on the rest of the side. So ODF, I'm sorry, I have no respect for them anymore, and I've lost all respect for the Forest Service, because every time we asked for help, we were denied. We asked two more times on our way out for help, and one of the battalion chiefs, I don't know, we didn't get his name, he called in, and a friend of mine called me and asked what was wrong, because they heard it come over their intercom that Virgil was asking for help, and he was denied. Now, that's not something I should have to pay for. So then, now they're wanting us to fix 2 miles of fence that burn out, which at a cost, that's $30,000 or more. $40,000 to replant trees, but yet the forestry doesn't have to replant their trees. That's going to bankrupt us. This acreage was our retirement. And then, what else is lost? Our town. Our town's gone. If Collins has no more logs for our town in the next 2 to 3 or 4 years, our town will shut down. Everybody in our town depends on our forest. We can replace our homes. We have insurance for that. You can't replace our forest. That's what we're getting at. This fire could have been stopped at Berry Point. But no, 60,000 acres of it was backburn. No, to me, they're not firefighters. They're arsonists. They start it. And that's criminal. If I had done that off of my property and burnt the forest, I'd be sued. But yet we don't even get any help from them. Not one speck of help. They won't even give us seed to replant. They won't give us trees. No, that's not fair. So as of right now, I have no respect for any of them. I can't even talk to them civilly. And I know it's not an individual person's fault, but it's hard. Because it wasn't our fault. And all these people behind me have lost. We've lost our livelihoods. We had 75 acres of erosion at $10,000 an acre. That's $750,000 loss on our property. Not counting the 57 truckloads of logs that they had to haul out that we got a whole $10,000 for, plus the 3 taxes that we have to pay. That won't even replace our fences. So everything's being put on a landowner when who owns the forest? We do. They should have to put it back too. We pay them the money. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we'll wait for questions till we're done with the whole panel. So who's next?
All right, I'm Nellie Evans, and I'm going to be reading my letter that I wrote for school. Okay. The Berry Point fire was both sad and devastating for our family. One third of the fire was grazing land for our cattle. We lost it all. We lost over 40 head of cattle. It was a big setback for the ranch. It has really been hard for the mill. They have lots of business now, but in a couple of years, they're going to have nothing to log. The fire got most of its fuel from the forest not being managed for the last 30 years. We now have no place to take our cattle. We got an evacuation level 1 at my grandma's house. It was only 1 mile away, and it was very scary. I went to the fire one day with my family, and it was really sad to see all the beautiful land burned. There were not all 40 dead cattle, like 20 dead, and the rest we had to put down because of the shells on their feet were falling off. It was really sad for my dad and uncle. All the timber on our private ground is burnt. They were going to use it as a retirement fund so that they didn't have to take money from the ranch for the new generation. My sister Cheyenne, my cousin Nicole, my brother Cash, and I. The Berry Point fire was very hard on our family and family ranch. That's all.
Thank you very much, Allie.
Thank you.
That was good. That was real good.
And then Dallas, my daughter.
With you. Take this to the third row.
My name is James Evans. I guess I look at things black and white. It should be damned embarrassing to the state of Oregon that the landowners are here asking to get the protection from ODF that we pay for. We should not have to be here. My brother and I were on the fire for 8 days. It affected the home place on the right-hand side of that map. It affected our private property on the left-hand side. And plus, we lease the Collins properties in California. One third of this fire is our family. I go back to accountability and ultimately ODF is responsible for us. The upper management ODF did not even contact us to go over with the landowners how they were doing or what we need to do until I contacted them in December. And when I called up there, I could not get a hold of Doug, but I got a hold of Nancy, and her reaction was that they did not realize that there was a problem in Lakeview or that people were upset. But she agreed to come. Doug could not come. So they came down, and we met. We still have not seen Doug down there. This is largest forest fire in Oregon, and we have still not seen him there, which I think is kind of an insult to the private property owners. But being on this fire, I go back. I related it to a lot of people as a rape scene. In the fact that we were trying to stay away from that fire and trying to keep our cattle moved, but on the other hand, we had to watch the government just as much to make sure they weren't trying to set something behind us or do more damage to us. We were getting money ripped out of both pockets. There was no one there on our side. That was a problem we have. I can recite three different instances on the Wednesday. In Yoakum, fire went through there Monday. On Wednesday, when we showed up that morning, the Forest Service was going to back burn the rest of our property. I asked the gentleman there with the drip torches not to. He said that was not a problem. I left for a while, rode through the cattle. I came back, and upper management showed up, and he started the drip torches again. And I said, I just talked to that gentleman over there. He said, we didn't need to do this. He said, I'm in charge, and we're going to burn it. I said, the fire's gone through 2 days prior. Why do we need to burn it? Basically, he said, to tie the lines in. We'd only have a 50% mortality on the rest of our property. I said, why would we accept 50% when we have zero right now? So this went round and round. He was a type 1 individual. He threw his gloves on the rig, and he said that he had 40 years experience and we're messing with his window of opportunity. I said, you are on private land. I know this is a Forest Service, but I go back to ODF is in charge of us. That night, we pushed cattle all day. That night we were getting in, we got a phone call that the ranch was on fire. When we got to the home ranch, it was not on fire, but it was coming. No one was there. The neighbors, Ace, Rosa, and several neighbors jumped on our equipment, put in our own fire lines to try to stop the fire and save it from our place. ODF's cat sat above our ranch a quarter mile away on a low boy. When do they show up? After we're burnt? That is my question. When the Forest Service, when I was running through our property, I ran into a Type 1 team getting ready to do their big box. And he drew the box so big through the Collins property, it was appalling. They were jumping up to 9 miles ahead to backburn. Where they were jumping was on the other side of the Fletcher fire from 2007, which they could not have burned through anyway because there's nothing left there. So the common sense is not there. So I told him I would help him with fuels, terrain, whatever I could to try to get him to fight the fire here. Don't be doing the box. One of his cronies or type 1 individual spoke up and said, and Ace was standing there, he said that if I was in charge, I would draw a box around it, burn it out, it doesn't matter who's out there, and private property is a pain in the ass to fight around. ODF should not be contracting or should not, I mean, if they are putting these people in charge or partnering with them, however, this is wrong. We do not have a hope. The arrogance and mentality out there is not for the landowner or the taxpayer. You know, where do we go? Where do we go from here?
They don't tell us no.
Hey, the incompetencies, I'll wrap this up. That I guess every level of government I have seen has been incompetent. I have dealt with Fish and Wildlife, Forest Service, ODF. But my favorite has to be when we filed tort claims. We get the tort back that says that they find ODF negligent and liable for the Berry Point fire. And then in the next paragraph, he wrote that they respectfully deny our claim. And I was awestruck over this for several days. And finally, I called the gentleman at the bottom of the piece of paper. And he says, well, he said, I made a mistake. He said, my spell checker didn't catch it. I said, you spelled nothing wrong. What's embarrassing here is the whole content of this letter reflects around two words, either do or do not. And you screwed that up. You are dealing with millions of dollars worth of claims, and no one proofread it? If that would have been the real world, and a doctor sent you a letter saying you had cancer, and waited 10 days or so to respond back to you, in the real world, you'd be hanging out there. But it's just kind of I don't have to do a good job. I just got to show up and keep my job. And we have experienced this time and time again. I'll give someone else some time to talk.
Questions?
Thank you.
Senator Close.
Mr. Chair. James, I was looking at your letter, too. And with Mr. Michael Baker responding, it looks like there's been a lapse of several days before he figured out that he had the wrong denial letter or whatever happened there. Did he send you any type of summary of, about why this was, why he did not find in your favor? Did he give reasons, or was it just this letter?
No, that letter. That was it.
Okay. Also, do you have any other recourse? I don't understand why the federal government wouldn't call this a disaster area so that you could qualify for some type of funding. Was that ever discussed?
Yeah, but a lot of it's an insult. We had one gentleman want to give us low-interest loans or cost share like Ace is talking about. What's embarrassing about this fire is for us and our neighbors, we would have been better off if the government didn't show up. The fire's running down the ridgetops. They circled through the valleys and lit up our land. So, and they just didn't do it once, but they did it twice. They backfired us once, and then they came back 2 days later and did a burnout. They have no respect for the resource. That the cattle that you've looked at in those pictures, as Ed Shepard said in his report, this fire was not wind-driven. And I can attest that because we stayed in front of it moving cattle. But we were never contacted when they sent the backfires into us. And that is proof that the dead wildlife you see in those pictures, you do not see that very often. But when it's killing wildlife, that tells you.
Thank you.
This thing was just... dysfunctional, I guess, would be the very dysfunctional. And we've seen no accountability 8 months afterwards. Everyone talks about moving forward. We're still cleaning up the mess. You know, let's clean up the mess first before we give you help to move forward. I'll quit there. Bill Tracy, who is probably the second largest landowner to lose timber, sent a letter that he'd like to have read. If that's okay.
Go ahead and proceed, yeah.
It says, the Committee of Rural Communities and Economic Development from William C. Tracy, DBA, Tracy Land Cattle Land Company. I wish to thank the committee for the opportunity to submit testimony concerning the Berry Point Fire of the summer of 2012 in Lake County, Oregon. I've tried to be brief and to the point as much as possible. The fire started August 5th, 2012, several miles west of our Drews Valley Cattle Ranch. It burned onto our property the afternoon of August 9th, 2012. I would like to inform you of several things. First, last November, I paid my taxes to Oregon Department of Forestry for fire protection. The tax totaled over $6,700 for 1 year. Number two, we had a dozer and three men on the fire, which I operated or paid operators. We built 4 miles of new fence to section off the burned area in order to continue grazing the cattle. Number three, the last fall, we ordered 50,000 two-year-old trees, which we paid for. The cost of the trees and the planting of the trees is over $30,000. If we do not have an approved number of living trees per acre, according to ODF rules, we have to plant again at our expense. Number four, the ODF and W furnished some seed for planting in the hottest area of the burn. We paid for the helicopter to plant the seed and were later partially federally reimbursed for our planting expenses. Five, any other seeding or spraying of noxious weeds will be at our own expense. Six, we are forced to decrease cattle numbers for several years to allow the burned range to recover. Seven, we have not been reimbursed for our damaged gate or for the two bulls which were trapped in the backfire north of DP 100. Number eight, the fire burned almost 3,000 acres of our private land. The fire started August 5th and burned east, entering our property the afternoon of August 9th. I asked ODF how many NS fire lines were put in between Berry Point, the start of the fire, and our property line. They could not tell me. The correct answer would be none. They did not fight the fire. The lines constructed only partially the afternoon of August were only a feeble attempt to slow the fire and were totally ineffective. I continue in great detail. However, in short, I was the only one on the north end of the fire on August 9th. No Forest Service or ODF personnel were present. On August 10th, we built lines with our dozer starting at 6 a.m. We finished work on our private land at approximately 9:20 a.m., and after an ODF dozer operator, he took a phone call to get him, showed up. We directed him as to where he should build a line to the east. No other ODF or federal firefighters or bosses were present until somewhere between 12 p.m. and 1 p.m. The ODF did not fight the fire. The fire line held that night. Our accomplishment was quite satisfying. But in constructing the lines, we gave the no-show firefighting personnel a line to work from. Sadly for us, we have lost nearly 3,000 acres of timber and rangeland. The ODF effort on my property was poor at best, but under current laws, their assessments will be the same or higher. They will not suffer a loss of funding. In addition, the landowners are forced to play their game. The landowners are the losers. In summary, the Berry Point fire cost us trees, 80 years of growth, at least 3 years of grazing, reforestation cost, firefighting cost, loss of value to our property, miles of fence, and the cost of replacing the fence, grass seedling expenses, endless hours of extra time that dealing with the fire has taken from us. The Oregon Department of Forestry continues collecting money from landowners and telling landowners what they must have by a certain date. Is this fair? I, for one, no longer hold any respect for the Oregon Department of Forestry. They, like the U.S. Forest Service, are totally dysfunctional and are playing games with private properties and our livelihoods. Bill and Ann Tracy.
Thank you very much.
And thank you. And if you want to leave a copy over there with her, we'll put it in our records officially as well.
We just got the okay to have the room until 5:30, but then after that we'll have to move to room 350. We can kind of have, you know, a follow-up. I know Senator Whitsitt, myself, Doug Decker will be there, Nancy Hurst. I think Representative Whitsitt had a question for this panel.
I had a question for Mrs. Harvey before you leave. You described a situation, I just want to make sure that I understand it, where you came upon a group of firefighters who were sitting playing cards, and your husband said they've lit a backfire over there. And this group of firefighters had no knowledge that a backfire was lit that was coming toward them. And they didn't believe it until your husband took them over to see the backfire.
Yeah.
So we've heard that their primary concern was for the safety of the people in this fire. And I think that's really important to understand that there was such a lack of communication that one group of firefighters not only may have burned you alive because you chose to stay in there, but they would have burned up the other group of firefighters. Okay, I just want to make sure that I understood that.
Thank you. There was no communication.
Okay.
At all.
Okay, thank you.
If you'll notice in the pictures that I have given you, there's a circle on one picture.
Mm-hmm.
That is 11:24 in the morning when the firefighters were showing up to the fire. And that is a person laying with his feet hanging out the window. That is on Collins land. So that explains the disrespect. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Bill and John Albertson. Thanks for being here, gentlemen, and please state your name for the record.
My name is John Albertson. I'm affected landowner in Berry Point Fire. I want to thank you all for giving us this opportunity. I'll try to make this as short as I can because I know you have all these other people here to do it. You've got some handouts there, and what this is the revised copy that I had sent to Ed, or the copy that he was revising for his report that he was doing for Kent Connaughton. So I want to go over that, very quickly, and I'd like to use Ed's map if I could stand there.
Absolutely.
For a couple of thank you.
You might have to speak up a little more.
I've got a big voice.
Okay.
Okay.
As stated on my report that I sent to Ed, prior to August 11th, myself and my family had no contact with the Forest Service or ODF in regards to the Berry Point fire. When I was contacted, it was Brother Bill had contacted me. He got an email from a family member saying that the fire was coming into Yoakum. And so I loaded a piece of equipment, a backhoe, on a trailer, followed Bill up, and we came to here, and then came across this block here to come in. This is Yoakum Valley here. As we come around this way, we encountered hotshot crews, probably 20 of them, dozens and dozens of people, and they're prepping this road, which at the time, I mean, we didn't have a clue as to why they were all there. But imagine, this is 5 miles ahead of the fire. We get into the Yoakum Valley, we get in right here, and we run into a hotshot crew leader that was coming off of some of our property. And we ask him what was going on and why all these people were out here. And he says, we're prepping to burn this block. There's 8,000 or 9,000 acres here called Governor's Ridge. The governor's plane crashes right here. I said, you're going to burn it? He said, yeah, it's going to be a burnout or a backman, whatever they're talking about. And I said, you're going to burn it to where? He said, we're going to burn it in the valley. We have a timber ground here. And so naturally, I was a little livid. I said, we haven't been contacted by anybody. You're going to burn this block, and you're going to burn it into our property. And he said, we're just doing what we're told. You know, don't kill the messenger. He said, we're going to put a fire line around your property, around the fence line. And I informed him that we had timber beyond the fence line. So anyway, he gave me the name of the IC. We went up right up here where I could get cell service, and I called the fire camp. And it took about 15 minutes for the IC to get on the phone. His name was Brian Watson. I told him who I was, where I was at, and what I found out. That they were fixing to not only burn 8,000 or 9,000 acres of forest and other private lands, but they were going to burn our timber. And we've been managing these lands for 100 years this year. We've been there a long time. So naturally, we're pretty protected. So when I informed him who I was, what I found out, his response was, sorry, my bad. This is coming from the incident commander. Well, that didn't set too well, did it? So I contacted ODF. I know both of the ODF guys there, Dustin Gustafson, the one that I called. Told him what I found out. He said, we're going to get things taken care of. Just, you know, cool your jets. He said, I'm going to send Mike Carlson up to talk to you, and another fellow by the name of Rick Wagner is going to call you. Okay, we're going to get things taken care of. He said, Mike's going to be up there real shortly, and this is him. So Mike did show up. I took him right up here. As you can see, where this line is, this is where the fire had stopped. It's right here. It's up against the rim in an old burn. And it was just smoldered. The fire had not come into the open. So I took Mike up here. And as you can see, this little spot right here, it's only a quarter of a mile across. And I said, Mike, you're going to back burn this thing. Don't burn this block over here. Burn it right here so you can burn it, you know, this way. His response was a good idea, but I don't think I get it past the beam counters. Referring to the ICP. And the other fellow that was supposed to call didn't call while I was there. I happened to call a friend called me when I was there. The guy from Climate Falls said, Senator Whitson knows very well, Willie Riggs. He said, hey, OSU extension there in Climate County. And Willie just called to keep checking on the fire. And I told him what was transpiring. And he said, I'm going to give your phone number to Senator Whitson. And from that day on, Senator Whitson has been involved with this, and we salute you for that, Senator. We appreciate it. Anyway, after that meeting with him, Bill and I retreated back into the valley, and we spent the night in the vehicle. Again in the morning, we got up, the valley's full of smoke, but the fire's laid down. It had not come past this area right here. We go back up to the cell area about 5 o'clock in the morning so I can make some calls. I pick up a phone call from the ODF guy that called me the night before, named Rick Wagner, and he left me a phone message.
and he told me, he said, we've got the whole idea of shutting or burning out the open valley shut down. And he said, I'm going to be up there to meet with you, and you know, we're gonna do a back burn. It's going to be something close that makes a whole lot more sense. And leaves his name, his phone number again, and then he doesn't turn his phone on, or his phone doesn't get turned off. And for the next 2 minutes, I listened to him laugh at us, make derogatory statements, and then make statements in regards to telling the buddy that's in the vehicle with him, who I don't know who it was, said, you should have been here the first day. We had 30 dozers sitting there doing nothing, and everything's turned into SI. And then they laugh about it. And all this time we're being told, you know, down the line, we didn't have the resources. But if you have 30 cats sitting there doing nothing, no wonder the thing went from there to this. So anyway, it didn't set very well. That was on Sunday. Bill and I spent the rest of the day there Sunday. Went home for a short time, late in the afternoon, because things were still right here. We came back in the evening. They started this fire here. This is on an upslope. They didn't start it from high to low. They started it here and started this backfire. We could see the flames. We stayed there about 11 o'clock at night and went home. Next morning, I went to the fire camp and to listen to their briefing. And if that's not a dog and pony show, you'll never see anything like it. And you wonder why it's 3 or 4 hours before these guys get out on the fire. So when I was there, I met with Travis and Dustin, or excuse me, Dustin and Greg Pittman. They introduced me to Travis and Beeman. Travis, who's Deputy Chief of Fire for ODF, said that he would like for me to meet with the IC commander, Brian Watts, and a guy named Steve Gage that's going to be the new one. I don't know which team.
Nemo guy.
There's five of them in this meeting. And so the first thing I said was to Brian, and his response to me, sorry, my bad. I told him that was not acceptable. And I had also been told by ODF that it had taken them 7 days, a week, to get on the same page as the fire team, the Forest Service. So when I had this meeting with them, I told the IC guys what the State Forest had told me. And they're all just kind of looking at their booth off. It's like they're all afraid that they're going to step on somebody else's toes. Anyway, I said, what do you people are fixing to do with this block up here and burn out us and some other family members? We irrigate 1,200 acres in this valley. Like I said, we've been there 100 years. We have a nice reservoir, and this is all part of our watershed. No regard for it. Anyway, I told them what they were fixing to do, in my mind, was criminal. And they said, that's not going to happen. We're not going to do that. When I left that meeting, I really felt assured that that was not going to take place. I drove to my folks' house to meet with Bill and my folks. My dad is still the major owner in these lands here. He's 88 years old, as well as my mother. And I sat down and had breakfast with him to tell him that we have this under control, that they're not going to burn us out. We had to sit down for 5 minutes, and a brother called that his wife owns another branch of their permitting up there, and he calls us from the same area. He said this fire that they set here last night was coming over the hill and was burning what we call a picnic ground. Again, we loaded equipment, headed up, came through the fire. We've got an access road that goes down into here. We ended up at this spot right here. And this line right here is a property line. And that's where the fire was coming into. But we caught that fire with two shovels and a backhoe and stopped the fire, as you can see on that straight line right there. Probably 3 hours later, here come two Forest Service cats and two helicopters. And the helicopters pounded this here. Did a whale of a job. One of the private contractors that was running the cat, we got him up under this rim and stopped the fire here as they were coming across here. Wyatt had left to go back and check the fire line, left Bill and another brother here. And I know it was 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and went over to check the fire line, went to this south point right here, and then I headed back up the hill and ran into the private contractor to try to give him a hand. And while I was there, I've been there for a while, I looked down, and right here, this is our access road again to get in here, our only way, only access into this property, only access in and out. I look down the hill, and there's a 200-foot wall of flame down where he's at. You know, and I think, what has gone wrong? So I head back down, I run into him. He's been looking for me because he sees what's happened here. He thought that I went south. Well, what had happened here is more hotshot crews. While we were fighting this fire, they were prepping this road to burn. And then shortly before they set this on fire, Sheriff McDonald showed up looking for my older brother because his wife was worried about it. That's what Phil wanted to say to you folks. When he got there, he was with us when they backburned this, and this is like 3/4 of a mile, at 2:00 in the afternoon. And the winds for that day were predicted to come out of the southwest, which is going to take it this way. And if you don't think things were emotional when we came together, he thought I was gone and I thought he was gone. And nobody to this day will tell us who authorized that. Nope. You don't think we haven't had some sleepless nights over it. Nobody wants to be encountered. And as far as ODF, protecting your lands, that's just not going to happen. Ace didn't. Ace was one of the guys that when this fire, when the Evans Ranch, when they thought the Evans Ranch was going to go, Evans Ranch was right here. And this fire was coming off this hill right here. And a friend that lives right here, and there's nothing sagebrush between here and there, he calls me because his wife was flipping out that their place was going to burn. So I get over there with my backhoe. State Forestry shows up and come over. We're probably going to have to put a line in up here. This is all canal bank from this road to this road, but it's vegetation covered. State Forestry, they go up here, they set up on the rim after the fire burned through. They would not come downhill. We have thank you water users with a grader. Ace was running the cat, and I had the backhoe. And we put 2.5 miles of line in there. While the ODF, who's being paid to protect our lands, is setting up on the rim, they said that we don't want it to go north. Several weeks after the fire was over, I called Dustin. I said, Dustin, I said, help me out here. How can I get reimbursed for the fuel and the repair on the backhoe? He's been up this 2 different times. His response was, you weren't invited to come up there.
How far across does that burn? So how long did it take you to get it over there?
From east to west, what's the,
from here to here, 15, 20 miles.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So it took you a little while to get your bike over there, too. Okay.
Well, I live
oh, you live over there. So you were going the other direction. Wow.
So I had come up through the fire. First time we come in this way.
Gotcha.
Second time we came through the fire here. I parked down here. Moved back in here.
Gotcha. Okay. Thanks.
Anyway,
Bill. I'm Bill Albertson. I'm affected landowner, I guess you could say.
And Bill, I might have to shorten your time a little bit.
I won't go back over other than when John was saying we went up to make a call, the 4017 road, the fire was east of that. And there was no firefighters on it. They were 2 miles over trying to prep this 8,000 thing. I mean, it was eerie. Here's the fire under the rim. No firefighters anywhere. And the same the day they lit us up, on the first back burn, we drove through fire on both sides of the road. It was 8 in the morning. There was no firefighters nowhere. I mean, that fire was doing whatever it wanted. It was low and slow. I mean, if we'd had firefighters out, you know, they could have done something. But this happened every day that we were around there. We felt we had to go every day to protect our property. Well, it reminds you of a bunch of goons out there. I mean, we couldn't do it, but the government can do it.
I had, not only with the phone message that I had, but we had an agreement with the state forestry and also the Forest Service. We had agreement that they were not going to burn our property. And even after having that agreement, they still did it, and they did it while we were on the property and knowing we were on the property. When Sheriff McDonald came down there, he stopped on the Forest Service Road where Access Road is, and he asked him, are the Albertson brothers still down there? And they told him, yes, they are. Phil goes down in there, and however long later, minutes, less than an hour, they torched it. And Senator Whitsitt was one of the first ones, I believe, that asked me when he toured the property. He said, if it wasn't you, Senator, it was Congressman Walden, said, did you fear for your lives? And we did. And they're talking their what their objectives are. You know, protect your lives, protect your private property. They failed in their objectives. As a lot of these other owners have said, ODF, right along with the Forest Service, is dysfunctional. They do not have the ability in this form to protect our property. I'll end it there.
But I guess just a few points. We met this liaison group that the state forestry was telling us about the day they burnt me. After they lit me up, if you will, on the back of your packet, this is out of the day shift fire plan for the day of August 13th. And the highlighted areas was they were telling the firefighters there were going to be southwest winds, gusty southwest winds, and they let us off. And if the winds had been like they usually are, which is southwest, we'd had no way out. But yet nobody thinks anybody did anything wrong. They'll say, right, we did a good job. You hear from people that weren't there, and it ain't what we see. And down here, I just had to highlight the safety.
Yeah.
But anyway, we were not protected. I never seen any state forestry rig of any kind until they lit us up. And they could not answer why, who gave the orders. We were not helped fighting the fire that they had lit the night before. Somebody gave them an order to burn us. And whatever become of the truth?
Bill, this is, just for the record, this is from the IAP from the fire.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, any questions?
Appreciate you being here.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I.
We appreciate it.
Yeah, I sorry for your loss, and I know these things.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we have Jared Bruce and Matt Morris.
I'm Jared Bruce. Thank you, Senators, Chairman, Representatives. Just to give you a little heads up, we're smack dab in the middle of the fire. We have a little 60-acre ranch. My wife and I bought it about 5 years ago because it was the prettiest piece of property we'd ever seen. This is our thing my wife and I put together. Just a few points. I think people think of Lakeview, if you haven't been there, you think, oh, it must be scrubby. These were pristine valleys here. We had 5 riparian areas with trout. We had multiple species of trees. It was just a beautiful place. And so when we took it over, we wanted to make sure we took care of this land. It was already fenced in. The whole 160 was fenced in with old fencing from 50 years ago. We had a bunch of government agencies out, you know, because we thought, well, hand in hand, we'll bring all these people out. They can tell us the best way to run it. So we've got a list of the consultations and visits We did water studies. We had fish and wildlife. We did conservation studies. We did everything we thought we could do in our power to get the best advice in order to protect this place. And unfortunately, all those conservation efforts from the government agencies we had planned, we had used and had help from, those same government agencies mismanaged this fire so badly. And one of the frustrating things about it is you can look at these pictures. If you go to the Berry Point fire timeline page, this page right here, you can see my brother-in-law was up there the entire time. He left for one evening. And the one evening he left is the day that our property got torched. We had 20 acres that had been burned at that point in the northwest corner and the southwest corner. You can see on the timeline, these are snapshots he took. The one with the truck in it shows the fire as it's gone past. And you can see that those trees are all there. The top page is that same area of trees at 1:30 in the morning being torched off. On the picture below it, that's after they got done burning down below the hotshot crews. They went over by our corral. And you can see, this is a really bad picture, but you can go on the website. It's all there. It's on a link on the blue. You can go on their own webpage, and you can see all of them with their drip torches lighting that up. The first picture is them just lighting off by the corral, and the second one is the result. It's timestamped 2 minutes later. There's no way you can say that that was not a hotshot crew lighting the forest on fire after the point. This is in an inversion. At nighttime, the inversion comes down. It knocks the fires down and out. And then in the mornings when the sun comes up and the wind and everything, it starts to pick up again. So this is not a natural burning fire where you have trees going off in the middle of the night. And just, you know, everyone's talked about the cleanup. This is just a small microcosm of what all these ranchers are dealing with. We have a small ranch. We're just getting started. You can see the hard work it took just to get 15 acres. I can't even imagine the miles of fencing, all the thousands of acres. This is just a small portion. We have a small story to tell, but it's about, this is exactly on a bigger scale what happened to these people, and I think it's sad to see what happened up there.
Thank you for this.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm Matt Morris. Thank you, Chair Senator Rowland and Vice Chair Berkshire Trigger. If I could step away real quickly from the microphone.
Just a real quick
point out. Right here is R-160, right in the middle. And it is the only full-time residence
in the fire. My elderly parents live there. They wanted to be here today. His disability and medical health precluded that. I was there 24/7, every day, every hour. The only honor I saw for the entire Berry Point fire was from these people. We've been in Lakeview for 5 years now, 4 years now, and we don't have the 100-year legacy like these families do, but they've certainly embraced us as such. The only reason we have our few cows still is because they took the time to come and get them and drive them out in their emergency cow drive with their herds. I could tell the story in full detail. I thank Mr. Shepherd for his very lovely PowerPoint demonstration, but I assure you it was much more colorful to see it with your own eyes. I'd like to clarify, even in the Shepherd report, as much of a snow job and whitewash as I believe it to have been, I even protested the report at its initial concept stage in December, questioning not Mr. Shepherd or Mr. Montgomery's integrity, but to hire a third-party independent fact-finding review to hire it out to career federal employees. I raised with Shane Jeffries, who is the Deputy Forest Director of Deschutes County, Deschutes National Forest. He came down to assist Fred Way. Fred Way is the Forest Supervisor of the Lake Fremont Wainema Forest. I said to Shane Jeffries, I said, is this I don't see the independent or the third party or the unbiased part of this. But to his credit, the report does state as early as August 9th that the decision had been made at the incident command to let the fire run all the way to the Ruby pipeline where they were going to make their stand. Granted, August 9th, the fire had not even come over Horseshoe Ridge yet, Horseshoe Ridge being about a mile north of our property. So the fire went through us on August 12th. So 3 days before, they decided to let us burn. I can attest and witness to every one of these statements that there wasn't any fire crews anywhere on the full 12 miles of the 4020 road that I traversed nearly twice a day, because I went to at least half of the morning shift briefings and the night shift briefings. And for some reason, the decision had been made at the incident command that all the employees, all the firefighters, all the crews had to requisition chow, uniforms, tools, fuel, water, on the clock at the Lake County Fairgrounds. 2 to 4 hours, twice a day, mind you, both at the morning shift and at the night shift, where there was nobody on the fire line because of the drive time, and they had to brief and debrief on the clock and get their chow and all of that. On about August 16th, I went into Larry Pingle, who was the planning ops trainee under Laura Meyer, who was planning operations under the incident commander at that time. And I said, why are you not running an overlapping shift? And he said, I've done that most of my career. It works very well. I went to the incident command. I said, how are we expecting to stop this fire with up to 8 hours of time in a 24-hour period where there's nobody on the fire? And they said, that's not your decision. That's what Larry's answer was to me. I made good friends with Larry. He was a pretty good man, kind of a bulldog, big muscly build. He had a little bitten off cigar all the time in his mouth. Looked like something you'd see from a World War II Iwo Jima movie or something. Likeable guy. I'll go back to the 12th. Our property in specific, the microcosm as he was talking about. I was there with the NEO Task Force, the Northeast Oregon Task Force, got a John Day Heppner. They were the structure team assigned to our buildings. They did a good job with both hand line and dozer line right around our buildings. That is the only positive I can say for the entire fire. The fire passed our property up on the ridge lines. Try to picture a horseshoe-shaped ridge around a valley with the opening right at the due south, where the creeks run out and the watershed runs downhill due south. The fire was running on the ridgetops. At about 6 p.m., the fire kind of came down. Actually, it might have been more like 4 p.m. This is when Sharon Harvey's talking about the fire coming onto their property. And I can attest to the fact that there was no crews that went to assist the Harveys. And we, in fact, owe probably a good portion of the unburnt portion of our property to Virgil and his cat and the work that he did in helping put line in up on the hill. The fire passed us about 6 p.m. And the zigzag hotshots, I was, to my everlasting regret, the one night that I was not on the property, the one night I did not spend the night there was August 12th, because I thought we were in the clear. I left at 2200, about 10 p.m. The fire was near the California border, which is, I'm going to estimate, is 3 or 4 miles south of the property. The zigzag hotshots, the crew boss's name was Diego. I met him. He assured me that they were just going to sit there and maybe do some pruning, but ensure that our buildings stayed protected through the night, along with the NEO Task Force night shift, which was crew bossed by a gentleman named Toshida. Well, they assured me that nothing was going to happen. The fire had passed us. We were in the clear. I came back 7 in the morning to find that they had drip torched, or that our property had burned. Calculating it later via map, about 105 acres. I didn't quite know that it was all the drip torching until later, when everyone posted or informed me to check out the Zigzag Hotshots Flickr and Facebook pages, where they posted pictures of themselves drip torching our property. And the pictures you see there in the brochure happened at 1 in the morning.
In the middle of the night, drip torched your property.
Yes.
Without telling you, without knowing who might have been on there.
Correct.
Nope.
Thank you.
Not even evening, in the middle of the night when people could be sleeping or, you know. I have four small children, so we weren't up there, thank God, but, you know, they don't know that.
On the morning of the 13th, I came out, and Brian Spivey, who's the crew boss of the NEO Task Force day side shift, I actually road marched out with them together. Excuse my military lingo. I did 6 years Army and Oregon National Guard. I attended the morning briefing on the morning of the 13th with the NEO Task Force day side. Road marched out with them to find our property burned. I actually found where somebody had lost their drip torch with the yellow, big yellow bag and the brass handles and the brass nozzles laying in our corral. I found it there. Somebody forgot it and left it there in the dark. Unfortunately, I didn't get a picture of it. I gave it to Brian, and he said he would ensure that it found its way to its rightful owner. I would love to be able to, it would take me about 10 minutes, I can tell you day to day, hour to hour, every single thing that happened, and I would love to do that further with you if possible. I have about 10 bullet points I'll make as quickly as possible. There's this very big problem with Forest Service policy where they say that in their own documents that a lightning started fire can be allowed to burn to achieve maximum fuel reduction benefits. That's in their own documents. It's in their own policies. It was apparent that that's what they did on this fire. There was no attempt to suppress this fire. Bill Tracy, that you heard, James read the letter. His brother's an electrician. I hired him to do some electrical work on our ranch. They were told the third day of the fire, this is being treated as a prescribed burn and letting run. That's what the engine crews told him on the third day of the fire. I understand I can't substantiate that here. The black perimeter became a battle point with the incident command and the branch commanders and the division commanders that I went up face-to-face with on a daily basis, because our property, being the only full-time residents within the fire, became abandoned once it was in within the black perimeter line. The policy is that it's too much risk to send firefighters within the black perimeter line. And they abandoned everything within the line. And there was repeated flare-ups, one to the tune of 600 acres, that burned fairly close in proximity to our unburned 20 acres in our buildings. And every time I called into the incident command, the response was, don't worry, that's a pocket cleansing itself. I can't tell you how many times I heard the term, it's cleansing itself. It became such an angering point that I actually got in a yelling match with a branch commander, Huddleston, when he refused to come to our aid and put out a flare-up about 300 yards, 400 yards south of our south property line. He said, "Oh, it's just a pocket cleansing itself. That's policy, to let it burn." Delos Divine is an ODF stewardship forester out of Coos County. He was the division commander for the last 10 days of the fire in our division. He was ordered to not mop up on our property, around our property, or secure our buildings or property. 3 times he went above his chain of command. He had to go 3 levels higher to get permission. And he said he refused the orders the first 3 times when he was told to stand down and not mop up, not defend our property, defend our buildings. And we traveled the 4020 road, and he said, I want to even mop up along the 4020 road because you depend on that as your lifeline to Lakeview. The Shepherd Report says, conduct a further review of the damages caused to the Morris, Harvey, and Albertson's properties as a result of burnout and backfire burning. That hasn't been done. When is it going to be done? They like to give us lip service, and the Forest Service and the ODF representatives like to say, well, the words I hear all the time are, well, we're looking into that, or we're developing a plan, or we're analyzing that information now. all it is continued lip service. And then to have the arrogance at the end of it in the meetings, whereas in December at the interagency office in Lakeview, to have a U.S. Forest Service employee, and I'll name her because as disgusting as she was in her behavior, Rochelle Huddleston, to sit in the back corner and point and laugh, roll her eyes and mock people who are sitting in this room as they gave their testimony of what they observed. I was sitting to the side and could see her doing it to the effect of, you know, like, look at this guy, what an idiot, rolling her eyes and laughing. I called it out to Shane Jeffries and Fred Way, and they assured me that she would be disciplined. She got a promotion. In closing, property rights for private property owners. We had theft on our property during the fire. I don't know when it happened. If it was the night I wasn't there, we had hand tools and fuel cans stolen out of our shed. On two occasions, on about the 16th of August, fire's way past us, and on about the 20th, 2 in the morning, I'm awoken by prowlers going through our outbuildings. This is 12 miles from the end of the paved road. I served 6 years in recon. I assure you, I know what I'm doing with a firearm. I went out armed. And they told me they were patrolling for hot spots. And I said, get off my property. I went down and talked with Larry Pingle the next day, and he said he would say at the press or at the briefing the next day that nobody was to be on private property unless in an emergency of life or limb of some kind of flare-up or blow-up, which I told Larry, if there's any kind of explosion of flame and it's 2 in the morning, please wake me up. That's fine. He assured me that it wouldn't happen again. It happened again. I'll close with that.
Any questions? Senator Whitson.
I just had one question. Earlier in your testimony, you pointed out that the fire ran for 3 days and that they had planned to address the fire at the Ruby Pipeline right-of-way, and that is really corroborated in the history of the fire. I mean, it was in the plan for 3 days. So the question is, did they attempt to stop the fire at the Ruby Pipeline?
Not that I saw. I'd like to add a note that on the morning of the 11th, when I came back out, we evacuated on the 10th at about 4 p.m. On the morning of the 11th, I went back out at a recommendation to check on our buildings by a friend. When I got there and there was nobody there, the fire was this tall in the grass, about 8 in the morning, pine needles and grass. It was the only fire. There was no canopy running. There was no torching. It was a perfect opportunity to stop the fire and put the fire out. But because of a 4-hour lack in shift change, there was nobody to be seen. But I called the incident command, I said, and I spoke with Ada Takis. She was the public relations liaison. And I said, where is the fire crews? Where is everybody? And she told me, well, they're going to let that burn all the way to the pipeline. I said, they're going to let us burn? She said, well, that was the decision that was made. She told me that. And it's corroborated in this whitewash of a report. And I can't. Our property is out of eyeshot of the Ruby Pipeline. I can't say that I saw the whole time that they were actively trying to stop the fire at the pipeline or not, because I was there. I was on our property, trying to mitigate flare-ups and that sort of thing. But I did travel with James Evans. I did travel down that direction a couple of times on my own. I did travel with James Evans to go put down a bowl with him. And I never saw any prep work on the pipeline. No dozer, no hand line. I mean, it's a 300-foot wide dirt swath that's only 18 months old. There's not even anything grown up on it yet. It's dirt. And there was nobody there. There was no fire crews there. You know, this report likes to say, the Berry Point fire priority between August 9th through 13th was the number one priority in the Northwest Fire District as for resources. Right there on page 6, number one. Those really pretty pictures of those bombers? No.
No.
number one priority, but we didn't have any bombers south of, they might have been up at Drew's Ridge, or excuse me, the Drew's subdivision, the Drew's Reservoir subdivision, but they were not any south of the Horseshoe Ridge.
It was really a rhetorical question. They did not.
Right. Sorry.
Mr. Harlan mentioned that after it crossed the Ruby Pipeline, it burned 22,000 acres of their property.
Senator Whitson, you also were asking Mr. Felder about the fence lines. And this picture right here on the front page of that is the fence line that we have now currently with huge old-growth timber just laying across our property.
That they cut and fell.
That they cut, they fell. And they said they were still not sure as to what they're going to do with it. It's just laying there on our property. So, and it's laying across creeks. It's laying across riparian areas. All these things that Oregon really strives to be is careful with their environment, and we're not seeing anything right now.
Representative Whitson?
Could you tell me a little bit about the zigzag crew that torched things in the middle of the night without knowing if anyone was there? You seem to know, kind of, were they federal or are they state? What was the zigzag crew?
It's a town.
I believe they're based out of Zigzag, Oregon,
right,
between Rhododendron and Mount Hood. I don't know who they were.
U.S. Forest Service.
Acting under, yeah, if it was Forest Service or ODF. But
U.S., okay.
20-man hot shot. All right, thank you. Any other questions? Okay.
Thank you very much.
The
opportunity.
I know you've come a long ways. All right, we have Commissioner Kestner, Commissioner Schoen, and Jerry Evans.
We'll let you lead off, Jerry.
Okay.
Well, my name's Jerry Evans. My mom and dad, my brother James and his wife, and my wife, Tawny, and I, we own Evans Ranch. And my brother and I spent every day on that fire. And I guess when you're thinking about this and kind of what we're talking about, I think a good analogy is that your house is on fire and you call the fire department and fire trucks from all over in several different counties come to your house, and they pretty much surround your house. Firefighters and everything, you got the shiniest, nicest fire trucks around, but because they can't get it together and they can't coordinate and they can't manage, they sit there among themselves and your house burns down. Now that's not a lack of resources. Every meeting just about that James and I've been to since this fire has been over, they talk about lack of resources. Well, if Doug Decker, if any of you are ever on a finance committee and Doug Decker comes to you and says because they need more trucks or they need more this, you think twice about what I'm saying, because they got the best equipment out there. Anyone in private industry would die for the kind of equipment that the Forest Service and the State Forestry has. I'll just tell you a story about this on the Saturday that the Saturday of the fire, and I can't remember exactly what date it was, the fire was burning over to Young Valley, a valley that our family owns. And there were trucks every place. I mean, they were coming from all over the place. And these are your $200,000-$300,000 pumper trucks and everything else. And nobody was stopping to fight the fire. Later that afternoon, James and I and my son-in-law and one of the guys that works with us, we finally stopped them. We said, what's the plan? They said, well, we're driving the roads, assessing the situation. For a full day, nothing was happening there. The next day, on Sunday, now our Young Valley's on fire and it's burning, and a guy came to James and I and he said, we're a day behind here. We need help. He said, we need help. And there's a crew of three loads of firefighters less than a mile away sitting there, and he said, they want to help us, and we want them to help us, but we can't get permission. And so they sat there all day long while our Young Valley burned. Now, you go to these meetings, though, and the first thing they want to tell you is lack of resources. I don't buy that for one bit. It's not lack of resources. It's managing resources. And that's the way this fire was run. I mean, it was a management problem. This fire didn't start out 93,000 acres. It ended up 93,000 acres. They lost control of the management of this fire. And because they lost control of the management of this fire got out of control. But one of the first, I mean, we've been to so many meetings here, and one of the things they tell you, this is a 93,000 acre fire, lack of resources. That's not the case. That is not the case at all. We were there, and we saw this from day one. But one of the things we haven't talked about here was the Friday night of the fire, they came to our parents' house, and they gave them a stage 5 evacuation. So my mom gave me a call, so I ran out over there, and my dad and I grabbed four-wheelers, and James was already had grabbed a four-wheeler, and we went up to a place called Horseshoe Meadows, and it's right up above the ranch where my parents live, and nobody was there. Nobody was there. Now, my dad was with me here, and then just a little history here. My dad managed the Collins Mills and their timberlands for years. And he said, you know, they give us a stage 5 evacuation. You expect to come up here and find somebody, and there was no one there. So Dad goes back, and he gets a hold of them, and they say that it was too dangerous. Well, James and Ace and I took Roy Montgomery and Ed Shepard through Horseshoe Meadows. James had taken pictures that night, and they had dates on it. And we stopped at Horseshoe Meadows, and both Ed and Roy said they could tell that was slow moving through there, and that was a good place, and correct me if I'm wrong, Ed, to pinch that fire off. But no one was there. Okay, if that fire had been pinched off there, we've been told by several people that are more knowledgeable than I, that would not have gone into California and would not have burned the Collins' 24,000 acres. Now, Dustin Gustafson told my brother that night, because James got and saw him ahead of time, he said, where are the people at? He goes, someone better get up here. Is that correct, James, or we're going to lose control?
I ran into Barry Schulenberg, who was the head of the Forest Service that night. The map says it all. It's the right here is Horseshoe Meadows. This is where I ran into Barry Schulenberg, who's the head of fire in Lakeview. He said, I asked where the firefighters are at. He said, I don't know, but if they don't get off their ass, they're not going to catch it. He went back and called Fredway, the SO, Forest Service there. Fred said, we're in over our head. I ran into Dustin Gustafson up on the ridge above. He asked me, where are the firefighters? I said, I don't know. I asked him, where was a good point to catch the fire? He said, either in the valley, which was below us, or the ridge top that he was sitting on. No one was there.
So this was a slow moving fire. I mean, at that point when my dad and I were up there, we were up there on four wheelers. We were at the fire. It was the closest from here to Doug to us. And so I have a hard time going to these meetings and talking about lack of resources and the fire conditions and stuff. There were opportunities on this fire. Now another thing that you asked a question, Doug, about was the day of the if they prepped the pipeline. That same Saturday. James called me. We had split up. James called me and on the radio, I think it was, and said, I understand, he goes, that they're going to drop back to the pipeline and use that as the backdrop. He goes, they're having a meeting in town at the fairgrounds. He said, can you go in there and go to that meeting and see if that's correct? Because at that point, that was, if they were going to drop back there, that was beyond the 4020 road. That was going to burn a bunch of our private land out. So my son-in-law ran into the fairgrounds, and I think Ken was in there. And so I asked him, I said, is this true? Are you going to drop back from the 4020 road and go to the pipeline? I said, if you do that, you're burning through a bunch of our private land and stuff. And he said, well, you have to look at the bigger picture. And I said, well, the bigger picture to us is you're going to burn through our private land here if you do this. But he said that's what it was. He said, we're going to drop back to the pipeline. This is on Saturday. And I said, well, what do you think your chances are of holding it at the pipeline? He said, if we can't hold it at the pipeline, we're going to drop back to the state line road. And I said, have you ever been on the state line road? And he said, no. The state line road is nothing more than like it's a trail. I mean, basically, for a big part of it, it's very unimproved. And if they couldn't stop it at the pipeline, it's not even going to blink at the state line road. So anyway, that's what they told us. Left, went back, and James and I met up later, and we talked about that. Scared us to death there because a big chunk of our deed was in between there. But, okay, that was on Saturday. On Monday morning, James and I were at the pipeline just a little after daylight. And no one was at the pipeline. And that's the day, that's what that morning, that it jumped over and got into the Collins' property. It's real steep on that pipeline on some places, and we were on four-wheelers and stuff, and it was just it was the oddest, probably one of the strangest days of my life. We got up there we weren't sure if it had crossed over or not. And we got off for 4 liters and we were walking around, and James walked over on the south side there, and it was just like panic. He goes, "The fire's already jumped over here," and we thought it was just a little bit, and we saw a little piece there, so we started trying to kick it and get it put out, and we thought it was just right there, and we realized it had gone in further in there, and there had been no prep work or anything on that, on the pipeline, absolutely nothing. Well, they had told us on Saturday that was their plan, and so when we got there and they jumped over, and then that's where we got in trouble. That's where we lost our cattle, majority of our cattle in there, and that's where the Collins has lost the majority of their land. But anyway, to answer that, there was nobody there. In fact, I got on the phone, tried to call Lee Flutter Johan, and just to let them know that it was now into the Collins' property.
Could we, we really are running out of time. Could we move to the commissioners? I'm sorry, but we've kind of already went through an hour over our room time, so we do want to hear from our commissioners from Lake County, too.
I'll let Dan Chown go first. Okay, I'm Dan Chown. I'm one of the Lake County commissioners, and I will be very brief. The reason we're going last is because you really needed to hear from the landowners and what has impacted them. And the unfortunate part is this fire has not gone away. This is as you've heard, 8 to 9 months later. Senator Witz has been very involved in this. Congressman Walden as well. But there's just too many unanswered questions, and that's what I keep saying every time I talk to anybody associated with this fire that has any control over the final outcome, which we don't see that inside anytime soon, is we've got to get these questions answered. We can't go back and resurrect the trees, you know. That we know that's past us. But there are too many people, too many families, too many affected parties that are part of our community and have been a part of the community for years and years that deserve an answer. And I'm just going to hit on a couple of things. Some of them have already been mentioned, but when we talked about that tort claim process with the state of Oregon, just talking about ODF, I was more than shocked when I saw the letter saying that the liability had been, her responsibility had been found on behalf of the state, and we are closing your files on this. I would have been equally as shocked if they'd have said it the way they ended up saying it, as far as the liability issue or the responsibility issue, simply because, to the best of my knowledge, nobody ever talked to anybody about anything. I don't know how they came to the conclusion they came to, one way or the other, on that whole process. The second part of it is one of the meetings that we had in December, and we had it at the commissioner's meeting room, and Nancy and other folks from the state were down. I think our landowners, and I know I am personally as a commissioner and a past member of the fire community, I spent 32 years in the wildland fire business. I'm very disappointed, and I don't know Doug Decker, and I'm sure he's a great guy, and he's trying to do the best job he can, but I really don't understand why we have not seen him in Lake County. You know, a lot of things, this is what I've said on this, and I can't speak for the landowners and how they would ultimately feel, but I truly believe 95% of the things that are still with us about this fire could have been taken care of early on by people actually coming out and working with the affected landowners and communicating and try to the best of their ability, because these are reasonable people, and try to the best of their ability to make restitution where it was appropriate, to own up to the responsibility. The reason I mentioned 32 years in the fire service, I made a lot of mistakes as a firefighter, and I hope when I made them, I owned up to it. And we're not perfect, we're humans. And so this whole thing just keeps bubbling up, and it's not going to go away until we get some answers. So thank you. Thank you. My name is Ken Kessner, one of the county commissioners. Like Commissioner Shallon, after 2 years of Marine Corps overseas and Peace Corps, 21 years with the Forest Service, 6 with the Bureau of Land Management, I moved around to different forests, started off in Southern California.
and we all know about fire in Southern California. I wasn't in the fire organization itself, but I've worked line, and I spent a lot of time on in the planning section of the fire camps. And all my career with the Forest Service, private land was always emphasized by the Forest Service, protection of our private lands. And you saw it up there three times listed in the report. I was ashamed, to be blunt, of how the Forest Service handled this fire with disrespect and total disregard for private property. Now we get to the point of ODF relationship with the Forest Service. When the Forest Service come in, there's a delegation of authority. I think ODF signed on to it. But the arrogance of this group, Forest Service, I could kind of see it through the smoke, and there's a lot of smoke, not heeding what ODF might have suggested anything. It's just kind of like put a block around it. Don't care if it's private land, burn it. My point at this point of time is the state needs to revisit their strength of interaction with the Forest Service.
Could I make one more comment? It had to do with the tort process. I believe it might have been you that asked the question about the tort process, or one of you did. That tort process that we filled out, and everyone in the affected here, that's a lengthy, very detailed process that you go through, and that's for your claim. And we spent hours and hours and hours and hours going through that. Now, no one called us and asked any of us any questions, because we've asked everyone, the landowners. No one asked, how was that investigated? Was it the state investigating themselves? Because we put all this effort into it, sent all the support, and then we get this letter back saying, basically, we find no fault. I mean, that's the second letter, and case closed. Where was the investigation? How could you investigate that without talking to the affected people from that? I mean, I think that's something that just should be found out just going forward. I don't know that it didn't come in and on this side of the desk, sit there a couple weeks, and go to this side of the desk and sign off and go from there, because none of us were asking any questions. I think it's pretty hard to do an investigation without some sort of investigation, I guess.
Sure. I'll just echo that again. I am still in shock, and I hope we get resolution on that, because Jerry's exactly right. You can't come to any conclusion, good or bad, the way it apparently was handled. It's just shocking to me.
Senator Roebling?
Yeah, I know this is about ready to get over. I just want to say thanks to all the people that came, and I have a totally different perspective than I had coming in, and I need to find some answers, and I need to figure out what went on and how our relationship between our ODF and the Forest Service works, because I have been watching the Forest Service, and they're under... The comments they made here were consistent with what they do a lot of times, is to let the forest reduction and get rid of the stuff and let the fire burn. And that makes me very nervous about other places and other parts of the state that have Forest Service connected to our state lands. And we need to, in my opinion, one of the big strengths of our system has been we take care of our lands. And it doesn't sound like that happened here. And I need to look at it a little bit more. And I appreciate you spending the time and coming all the way here to do that. And so from my perspective, it's been an informative meeting. And I appreciate the fact that it was asked and we had it. And I want to concur with you when you said that these people here are pretty reasonable, understanding people. They have behaved in that way. They've done the kind of stuff. The information I got, I'm very pleased and very... personally, I look at these people the same as the people I work with in Coos Bay, that these are real honest people who wanted to do the best that they could. And I appreciate that my Coos Bay guy tried to do his best. So I'll give him help for that. Because, we have our own fire district separate, as people know. Douglas has it, too. And I work with those people. They take it very seriously. And my hope is that we can make sure we get not only some answers for you, but... and understand how best for us to proceed in the future.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Based on what I've heard, I thank you, all the families that have come forward, and I know it's not easy to tell your story, but if you didn't come and tell us, we wouldn't know it. It's very, very important for us to hear it. And in my district, and having Douglas County and having the Douglas Fire Protection Association, and what I've learned from them, it doesn't seem like it worked here. Right. In the sense of the process of what it's supposed to be. Yeah. And I really, and I know that we have our Forest Department here. I want answers as to what, how we actually integrate with the feds, and especially integrating where we have public and private lands. Because if we're signing off the authority to let the feds actually control and be the IC, and we have private property that's being engaged and blocked off, something is wrong there.
Right.
Because, you know, that's not the way.
How do we do it?
Well, it's not how it's, as I've been told, it's been done. And so I think we do need to have a fuller, broader discussion. I'm going to ask the chair.
Yep.
I know this is right in the middle of the session. We can't get into the details, but we got interims, and that's what interims are for. And I hope that we can actually have more so we can actually see what our relationship is. I don't know if we can get the feds to come and give us answers that
as yep, a state. We have a letter to them.
We have a
they
letter.
They have not told us no yet. They did respond that they received it, and we appreciate that.
Well, we're having Representative Walden and DeFazio and others that represent big rural areas, I think we need to get them involved and maybe have a joint state-fed delegation investigation.
Yep.
I'd like to chip in. I've experienced some very good fire teams that I've worked with over the years, very good Forest Service supervisors and managers, and some very good state fire, but on this scenario, that all did not come together.
Okay, so I thank everybody. So what we have is we have room 350, which isn't that on the third yep. floor, right above the governor's office, right yep. in the middle of the building. So we have that reserved. Our state forester will be there maybe to answer some questions. It will not be part of this hearing. It will not be on the record, okay? The only thing that's on the record is what we're discussing here today. So, but it will be, I'm sure, another informative meeting, and it'll give you some chance to ask some questions. Senator Whitsitt will be there. I'll be there. I don't know anybody
I'm not
else.
Be able to be there. But do we have anybody still on the phone? Are you still there, Mr. Harlan?
I am.
I am impressed. I am totally impressed. Yeah. I just didn't want to go unnoticed that you've been patiently listening to all this, so hopefully you've heard it well.
Thank you.
Yes, and thanks for staying on, Paul, and we'll be talking to you here in the future.
I would like to offer you guys a tour of the fire at any time.
Okay, I appreciate that, because I may try to figure a way to get down there. We'll see what we can do, maybe even with the committee at some point in the interim. So yeah. Thank you for that offer.
Oh, we're going to have you state your name again.
Ace Felder. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody, and I guess we'll see you up at room 350.
Bye, Paul. I'm going to say goodbye.
Okay, we adjourn the hearing on the Berry Point Fire, and we adjourn our meeting for Rural Community Economic Development.